This is Freemasonry Today magazine, issue number 54 for summer 2021. FMT is the official journal of the United Grand Lodge of England. The editor is Donna Hardy, and the editorial panel is Michelle Warville, Sean Butler, Guy Roberts, Barry Hughes, and Julian Perry, the culture editor. It is published by Sunday at 207 Union Street, London, SE10LN, on the web at www.wearesunday.com for the United Grand Lodge of England at Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street, London, WC2B5AZ. You can contact, for Masonic inquiries, editor@freemasonrytoday.com. Call 020-7831-9811. On the web at www.ugle.org.uk. In this audio version, we have included the articles in the order in which they appear in the printed magazine. We have not included any of the advertising material. First, let's take a look at the contents page. Starting with, from the Deputy Grand Master, Jonathan Spence, guest edits the Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe Ease column and welcomes you to the summer issue. And then the out and about section starts with, in memory, His Royal Highness the Prince Philip, a brotherly tribute to the Queen's consort, and followed by news and views from the provinces, UGLE's Jabs Army and Charity Success. And then in the stories section, we have Top of the Cops, Norwell Roberts QPM on his pioneering 30-year career in policing, 60 Seconds with Gareth Jones OBE, PGM of South Wales and third Grand Principal, Light Blues Brigade, new and young Masons Club on offering engagement and learning, and the interview is Dr. David Staples, the Grand Secretary on modernising Freemasonry while preserving traditions. A daily advancement section is the QC Writes, Dr. Rick Berman on John Montagu. In the Grand Lodge section, quarterly communication, Programme Master Peter Lowndes. Learnings Online is onboarding with Solomon. Museum of Freemasonry, Beneficent Dentist and Brother Bartholomew Ruspini. And in the Royal Arch section, we have the Savage Club chapter, reviving a time-honoured ritual, and essential reading, Chris Clark on his years as Deputy Metropolitan Grand Superintendent. In the culture section, there are book reviews, and in the community section, the charity and craft article, how the MCF and Freemasons nationwide are providing a much-needed lifeline. And finally, the letters section.
On page 3, from the Deputy Grand Master. It was with a degree of trepidation that I accepted the invitation to guest edit the Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E's opening column in FMT. It is quite an established custom for the Grand Secretary to set the tone for the magazine with reflections on recent events, detailing forthcoming developments and engaging with the readership. I was told, "You have a blank canvas. Over to you." The last 15 months, from the run-up to the first lockdown, have been some of the most challenging for our country and society that most of us can remember. The tragedies experienced by families throughout the land will be with us for many years to come and will leave their scars. There have been periods when familiar aspects of our lives, such as spending time with our extended families or seeing our friends at lodge meetings, were no longer available to us. I have heard it said many times during the pandemic that Freemasonry has gone into abeyance. This is certainly true for our physical lodge meetings. Zoom, WhatsApp, and even old-fashioned telephone calls have all been helpful for staying in touch, but are no substitute for personal contact. In another sense, so many of our members have remained active in demonstrating the values and ideals of Freemasonry. They have engaged wholeheartedly in our communities and contributed to our society in so many practical ways, as well as through the joint efforts of UGLE, the provinces, and the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemason charity, in supporting local charities. The Grand Master granted 258 certificates of commendation to members throughout England and Wales for their outstanding contribution to Freemasonry's role in our nation's fight against COVID-19. This emphasises something the Grand Master has made clear on numerous occasions. It is the engagement with our communities in practical ways, with our members using their many and varied skills, which is one of the key traditions of being a Freemason. These practical efforts have not slackened, even as we saw the hoped-for end of the pandemic come into view. In late March, as the vaccination programme was in full swing and almost 30 million people had been given their first jab, I received a message from a friend and brother. He had just visited his local clinic on a Sunday to be vaccinated and was delighted to say all the volunteers supporting the medical staff were members of a local lodge. To all who have contributed to these efforts, thank you. As you will be aware from the annual report published in April, the Pro-Grand Master asked me to chair a small working party to consider the future strategy for UGLE. We benefited with ideas from a number of the other working parties looking at membership and communications, as well as comments from updates provided by provincial Grand Masters and Grand Superintendents on what they felt should be addressed in 2022 and beyond. One of the key considerations was how best to articulate clearly both our purpose and the tangible effect of being a Freemason today. There is a much greater awareness in society of the need for organisations to state their values and to live up to them. Those that do will hold the commitment and engagement of members old and new. The conclusion was a mission statement published with the annual report that presents what Freemasonry is and what its members do. This can be shared with our families and is a good basis to talk about Freemasonry with those who are not Freemasons. Within the mission statement, there is a challenge for us all. We must ensure that Freemasonry under UGLE enhances its reputation as a thriving organisation that people aspire to join and broaden our membership across all age groups. This is something to which we can all contribute, both as individuals and within our respective lodges. Without your support, we cannot succeed. This is not something that can be done by UGLE, the Metropolitan, Provincial and District Grand Lodges alone. All lodges and members have a crucial role to play. It is as important to engage and enthuse our current members as it is to attract potential new ones. Your enthusiasm is the best advertisement for potential future Freemasons. I very much hope, brethren and companions, that by the time you read this, the government will have been successful in following its roadmap out of the pandemic, and that lodge and chapter meetings will have resumed in a way that we can all thoroughly enjoy again. Jonathan Spence, Deputy Grand Master, Cambridge, Easter 2021.
Page 6 has an in memoriam for His Royal Highness the Prince Philip, Philanthropist and Freemason, it's entitled. Not only did the late Duke of Edinburgh share our charitable values, he was also a fellow Freemason. We celebrate a life well lived and share your memories of His Royal Highness, the Prince Philip. The Duke of Edinburgh became a Freemason in 1952 at the age of 31. He was initiated into Navy Lodge number 2612 on the 5th of December. On the 6th of March 1953, His Royal Highness the Prince Philip progressed on to the second degree of Freemasonry before advancing to the third degree on the 4th of May 1953. United Grand Lodge of England, UGLE, issued his Grand Lodge certificate on the 7th of May that same year, and he remained a member throughout his life. The Duke of Edinburgh was born on Corfu on the 10th of June 1921, the only son of Prince Andrew of Greece and Denmark and Prince Alice of Battenberg. He therefore held the title Prince of Greece and Denmark. In 1939, Prince Philip joined the Royal Navy as a cadet, following in the footsteps of his grandfather, Prince Louis, who was Admiral of the Fleet and First Sea Lord. He had a long and successful career and rose to the rank of commander. Prince Philip was also a qualified pilot and was the first member of the royal family ever to fly out of Buckingham Palace in a helicopter. As a Freemason, Philip was known to drop into meetings at his Freemason's Lodge almost unannounced. Navy Lodge has a storied past, and an amazing roster of luminaries appears upon its membership roll. The Lodge prides itself on being the premier naval lodge in the world, with an unparalleled history that includes four monarchs as past members, that's King Edward VII, King Edward VIII, King George VI, and King George II of the Hellenes. Freemason can count other members of the royal family amongst their number, including His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent, the longest-serving Grand Master of UGLE. As well as members of the royal family, Navy Lodge can proudly name three winners of the Victoria Cross amongst its past and present members, numerous admirals, generals, vice-admirals and senior officers, as well as other notable names such as Sir Ernest Shackleton, Robert Scott, known as Scott of the Antarctic, and many more. There is also a Duke of Edinburgh Lodge, number 1182, Liverpool, which was issued a warrant on the 2nd of July 1867 and was consecrated on the 1st of August 1867. The lodge was named after Prince Alfred Ernest Albert, who was the then Duke of Edinburgh and the son of Queen Victoria. In addition, there is a Duke of Edinburgh Lodge in London, number 1259, which was consecrated on the 4th of May 1869. The lodge was also named after Prince Alfred Ernest Albert, who became Duke of Edinburgh in 1866. On the 9th of April this year, Freemasons came together to pay their respects to a special edition of Time to Toast, led by the Pro Grandmaster Peter Lowndes. Freemasons have also launched a campaign inviting their 200,000 members to raise funds for charities that the Prince supported. Throughout his life, he was patron, president or honorary member of some 992 organisations, with special interests in issues from technological research to conservation. Dr. David Staples, chief executive of UGLE, said Prince Philip was well known for his charity work, having been involved with numerous organisations. He was devoted to philanthropy, and therefore the best way to celebrate his life is by supporting the charities that the Prince himself supported. For us, this was an easy decision, as Freemasonry's core values are charity, integrity, respect and friendship. The Freemasons have been quietly getting on with making society and the lives of those less fortunate better for more than three centuries. And so, over the page, we begin Prince Philip Remembered, Reflections on a Royal. In response to our call-out, we received a fascinating range of stories from Freemasons sharing their fond memories of the Duke of Edinburgh. First, Mike Swift, Secretary of Berry's Lodge, number 2928, PGL, Berkshire.
I was the chief photographer of the Windsor Observer for 25 years until January 2020. I took numerous pictures of him, and I really will miss him. He had a reputation as a man that was impatient with the media, but I often shrugged my shoulders and pulled away while other photographers got in his and Her Majesty's face. Over the years, they both made a point of looking straight into my camera and waving when on duty in Berkshire, so I always got a great picture. I wasn't the only one, but no one that ever got in their faces ever got the look. I am honoured to have photographed His Royal Highness for so many years and at such close quarters. Above is one of my images from over the years. Mike Swift, Secretary, Berry's Lodge, number 2928, PGL, Berkshire. And accompanying that memory is a photograph of Prince Philip waving from a short distance away towards the camera across the bonnet of a car.
The next reflection comes from Worshipful Brother Richard Godley, PPGS WDB, Province of Yorkshire and North and East Ridings. It was a very long time ago now, in the late 1960s, when I was a lonely leading seaman in Her Majesty's Royal Navy based at HMS Vernon in Portsmouth. Awaiting my aircrew course, a pipe was made for the duty coxswain, me, and crew to report to the guardroom. On arrival, I was told that I was to take some dignitaries in the Admiral's barge to Cowes on the Isle of Wight, as it was the Cowes Festival. Despite my protestations that I'd never driven the thing before and only had a very vague idea where Cowes was, I was told to get on with it by the officer of the day. Anyway, three of us, myself plus the bow and stern men, changed from working rig into sailor suits for the trip. It was glorious, flat, calm weather, and when the passengers arrived, one of them was the unmistakable figure of the Duke of Edinburgh, who never failed to attend Cowes Week as a competitor. We got underway with impressive boathook drill and due caution by me, and on leaving the harbour, the Duke looked at me and jerked his head in the direction of the island as if to say, "Get a move on." Slamming the throttles of the twin Gardner engines forward made those passengers standing sit down heavily, and the rest to cling on for dear life to whatever they could. This was indeed a speedboat. Oh, yes. Smug in the knowledge that I was flying a white ensign and an admiral's pennant, I could do no wrong. I weaved in and out of a Cowes flotilla, their crews waving nicely, with my sailor's collar streaming behind me like a Hell's Angels bandana, and wearing a maniacal grin, I had the thought that I'd do a bit of showboating, approaching the jetty at speed and coming to a stop at exactly the right place, whilst gracefully accepting the undoubted applause of the reception committee. Well, the first part of the plan went well. The second saw the boat sliding under the jetty in clouds of diesel smoke from over-revving engines in reverse. Unfortunately, Prince Philip lost his hat in the process, which was retrieved by my quick-thinking stern man and swung with all the grace of a fisherman landing a tuna back to the Duke. Normally, a passenger would turn to the coxswain and thank him. I simply withered under a direct, narrow-eyed glare. I was not asked to return for him, but was told later that HMS Vernon had been contacted, and that blethering idiot was probably the mildest imprecation directed at me. R.I.P. to a great man.
Accompanying this memory is a photograph of a young man in conversation with Prince Philip as they both stand in front of some electrical equipment, and the memory reads as follows. "This is me giving a presentation to Prince Philip, who was Colonel-in-Chief of REME. Taken at Electronics Branch Malvern, His Royal Highness was visiting the unit and the equipment on show was the Klansman Automatic Test Equipment. Klansman was the radio communication system for the Army. I remember him asking some searching questions. This was in 1984, and the only previous knowledge I had of Freemasonry was hearing singing at a Masonic dinner that my grandmother catered for in King's Lynn. Worshipful Master, we will take wine with you. I think I was around 10 or 11. In February 1991, I was initiated into Gateway Lodge number 8474. Robert Castle."
I met the Duke of Edinburgh when he accompanied the Queen on an overseas engagement at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting held in Malta in November 2015. Prince Philip hosted a lunch for local sponsors of the Duke of Edinburgh's award, which my wife Jackie and I attended in the grand surroundings of the Casino Maltese in Valletta. We were introduced. He asked what we were doing in Malta. I explained that we were expats, when he interrupted me with a twinkle in his eye to ask, "What are you running away from?" "The weather," I replied. He laughed heartily. He and the Queen had arrived in Malta during the worst November weather we had experienced on the island in some years. He gave a speech at the lunch. Given his age, we were expecting that the audience might need to be understanding if there was a little hesitancy in his delivery. Not a bit of it. He spoke with fluency and without notes. He struck us as a man of charisma, with a real sense of humour, who was also consummately competent in his role. And that's the very worshipful brother Dr. Lawrence Porter, PG, INSP, Malta.
My first introduction to Prince Philip was as second officer of the Guard for a full Royal Guard, marking a visit by the Duke to the Royal Naval Air Station at Culdrose. This was some 8 years before I was initiated into Navy Lodge, his lodge. David Swain, Metropolitan Grand Secretary.
During the 1990s, I was a police motorcyclist in Bristol. One Friday evening, I was tasked with meeting Prince Philip's car at our force border and escorting him and his party to a private music recital at a venue in Bristol. The concert started at 7 p.m. and was due to conclude at 10 p.m. Having arrived at the venue, the Duke thanked me for my help and then went inside. I stayed with the Prince's driver, and during the course of the evening he told me that they were going back to Windsor following the concert. However, because they would miss dinner, the staff had prepared some hampers for them to eat on the way back. At the end of the concert, the Prince spent longer than expected talking to his fellow guests and so didn't return to his car until about 10:45 p.m. He apologised for being late, then asked if I had eaten that evening. When I told him that I hadn't, he asked his driver to open the hampers, and we then spent 20 minutes stood at the back of his car sharing a selection of sandwiches, pork pies and fruit. He told me how he had loved riding motorcycles when he was younger and asked about my career and family. He was a thoroughly pleasant man with a genuine interest in people. It was an evening I'll never forget. And that's Richard Villis, Almoner, Safeguard Lodge 9566.
In 1994, Prince Philip flew to Bermuda to present Duke of Edinburgh Gold Awards to students at Bermuda Government House. He spoke with each of the awardees, and I remember answering a number of questions about my studies and extracurricular activities. He was quite the character, too. At the end of our conversation, he asked my father, "Where do you think the governor keeps his good whisky?" They then conducted a search of Government House for the good stuff. Even though it was almost 30 years ago, meeting Prince Philip remains one of my best memories. Michael W. Branco.
This next reflection is from Nick Fell. A memory I have of Prince Philip happened on the 11th of July 1980, during the commissioning of HMS Invincible, when I was then 11 years old, that he attended alongside Her Majesty the Queen. My father was a chief petty officer in charge of the Sea Dart missile system and an ex-submariner. Hence, during the celebrations, he was wearing his submariner's dolphins on his number one suit. Prince Philip noticed these and came across to ask my father if he was on the wrong ship, pointing to his dolphins. My father assured him that he wasn't, and they laughed. He then looked at me and asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up. I replied, "I want to be like me dad," at which point my father grimaced at my incorrect grammar, just as a photographer took our picture. Somewhere in my files I have a picture of me meeting Prince Philip, with him laughing and my father grimacing. As fate would have it, I did indeed join the Royal Navy in 1989 and served on submarines. I then became a chief petty officer, and my final draft was on board HMS Invincible, wearing my dolphins, on one of her last tours before she was decommissioned. Hence, a chief fell served on her at the very start and at the very end of her service.
From 2004 until my recent early retirement, I worked as the locomotive engineer accompanying members of the royal family during many journeys around the UK on the royal train. These often took place overnight, stabling at some heavily guarded remote location before the final drop at the destination, within 15 seconds either way of the allocated time, the most punctual train on the network. It was often at these final destinations that we were subject to the Duke's acerbic wit. On many occasions, walking past the locomotive cab as myself and the driver were stood to attention, he would comment, "You managed to find it then," accompanied by a wry smile. On one such occasion, I was brave enough to retort with, "Yes, sir, we have had a sat-nav installed in the cab." He laughed, gave me the pointed finger, and moved on. A few months later, as there were probably only around 15 to 20 trips per year, again he followed Her Majesty the Queen past the cab. I bowed my head and was surprised to find the Duke had stopped right in front of me. I was quite taken aback, but the Duke smiled and said, "Sat-nav still working, I see." "Oh yes, sir," I sheepishly replied, knowing full well, such was the Duke's knowledge, that we both knew there was no sat-nav. He laughed, winked, and moved on. There are many other stories of a similar nature that I remember, and I have very happy memories of my time spent in the company of a truly great man. Brother Wayne Millard, Lodge of St. Blaise No. 6113, Warwickshire.
In the early 1990s, I was working on an exhibition stand at the NEC for a home improvements company. On the stand was my colleague, Colin Deans, MBE. We knew that Prince Philip was visiting the exhibition that morning, and Colin said to me, "When he comes this way, I'm going to speak to him." I had no idea what he had in mind, but in due course, along our aisle, came the Duke and his entourage. As he approached our stand, Colin walked straight up to the Duke and said, "Good morning, sir. Can I interest you in some double glazing?" I flinched, but then watched, amazed, as Colin and the Duke got into a deep and animated discussion lasting 3 or 4 minutes. When Colin returned to the stand, I asked him what they'd been discussing. He explained that he knew the Duke from meetings that he'd had with him during his active rugby-playing days. Colin Dean's MBE was a former captain of the Scottish rugby team and an outstanding hooker, rated by some at that time as the best they'd ever seen. And that's from Martin Hugh Tarran Jones, St Edmund Lodge, number 6451.
In 1951, at the Festival of Britain, myself and two school friends were standing on a small bridge looking at something in the water when suddenly a voice boomed out, "Come on, boys, bugger off, you're in the bloody way." Prince Philip, bless him, still makes me smile so many years later. What a loss to us all. Arnie Mason, Provincial Assistant Grand Standard Bearer, Eldon Lodge, number 1755.
I was involved in the security of VIPs when they visited Lancashire. Prince Philip had chosen to visit his shirt maker, a company based in Bitton, just north of Blackpool. He decided to drive himself from Blackpool Airport in a plain, unliveried Range Rover across the busy town centre and into the venue. I managed specialists in security escort, driving and riding motorcycles, and they practised their trade regularly. However, on this occasion, the Duke tested them to their limits with his desire to drive at speed. The team had great difficulty keeping up with him and expressed the view that they'd never experienced anything quite like it before. They acknowledged that the Duke was a very skillful driver. And that's from Mike, PAGDC, Provincial Grand Standard Bearer, 8PGP in Province of West Lancashire.
During my feckless youth in the late 1950s and 1960s, I lived in Barbados for 7 years, long before it became the playground of the rich it is now. During my time there, Prince Philip was making an official tour of the Caribbean with the Western Atlantic Flotilla. He was to visit Barbados and open the new Queen Elizabeth Hospital, and also open Parliament. We, a bunch of expats, had just founded a rugby club and challenged the Royal Navy to a match at the Garrison, the local horse track just outside Bridgetown. The match was played in the cool of the early morning, and Prince Philip came to watch. The Navy narrowly beat us, and we all repaired to the polo hut, which we used as our changing facility, for a glass of the local lager. Our charming and delightful visitor asked if we would like to come back to the Royal Yacht for some English bitter, but we would have to make it a quick visit, as his official duties were due to begin mid-morning. We did not need to be asked twice. There was no time to change, and still in our kit, we piled into assorted vehicles and set off on the short drive to the Deepwater Harbour and boarded the Royal Yacht Britannia. We had our beer and waved the Prince off, dressed in his very smart Admiral of the Fleet uniform, and had more beer at the insistence of the extremely hospitable crew. I don't remember the rest. Mr. Michael Francis Jackson Croker, Bishop Auckland, County Durham.
I had the pleasure of meeting Prince Philip on 3 occasions, serving on the Queen's flight from 1969 to 1973. At that time, Prince Charles was learning to fly in a Bassett aircraft, of which I was part of the maintenance team. When Charles gained his pilot's licence in August 1971, he laid on a barrel of beer for the members of the Queen's flight at RAF Benson, at which the Duke of Edinburgh was in attendance. Sergeant John Collins and a few of us helped in collecting VIPs' ties on visits to the flight. So, on that day, we approached Sir Archie Winskill, equerry to the Queen, to ask if we could have the Duke's tie. During the beer call, Prince Philip came to our small group and, after a chat, said, "I believe you chaps would like my tie," and started to take it off. However, John said to Prince Philip, "Sorry, sir, not like that, like this," and then cut his tie below the knot with a pair of scissors to add to our collection. He took it with good humour and asked about our collection. John replied, "Sir, you're in good company, along with Sir Douglas Bader." And that's from Brother Norman Shanks, MBE, Charity Steward, Sodbury Vale Lodge.
My father, then Petty Officer Lawrence Crabtree, served in the Royal Navy during World War II on various ships, including HMS Whelp, where he served as a gunnery officer alongside Prince Philip in 1944. Over the years following the war, he spoke many times of his time in the Navy, but what he recalled most was the time spent with Prince Philip. During his later years, my father had mentioned to one of his golfing colleagues that it would be nice to see Prince Philip once again. His colleague, unbeknown to my father, wrote to the Duke of Edinburgh in February 1997, and on the 10th of April 1997, my father received a letter from Buckingham Palace, sent by Captain the Honourable James Geddes, Gren, GDS, which read, "Mr. Hollis, a friend of yours, wrote to the Duke of Edinburgh in February with the hope that you may once again meet His Royal Highness, as you once served together on HMS Whelp during the war. His Royal Highness remembers you from that time, and has asked me to inquire whether you would like to attend one of the Royal Garden parties this summer and meet Prince Philip again." My father promptly replied that he would look forward to meeting Prince Philip at the Royal Garden party on the 24th of July at Buckingham Palace. My father and I received our official invitations from Her Majesty the Queen on the 13th of June. At the garden party, when we were presented to Prince Philip, he turned to me and said, "When your father first joined the Whelp, I told him, jokingly, I wasn't sure whether I should let him on board, as he had already been sunk twice." My father had survived a sinking in the North Atlantic in 1941, and also a sinking off Bougie, Algeria, in 1942. They both reminisced about the time they shared in the Royal Navy, and it was clear by the stories my father and Prince Philip shared that they had a strong camaraderie. As the day drew to a close and we left the palace, my father said he always remembered what the prince told him when he left the ship. He said we would be shipmates somewhere, sometime, which meant we would meet again, and he made it happen. My father sadly passed away 9 years later, contentedly. Worshipful Brother Alan Crabtree, Lodge of Peace No. 322, Provincial Senior Grand Deacon.
I had the great honour of being presented with my Long Service and Good Conduct Medal personally by His Royal Highness Prince Philip, a very proud day for me and my family. And that's from Peter Crimmins.
I encountered Prince Philip in the early 1970s when he was taking part in a carriage driving competition at Lowther Park near Penrith. As a member of the then Royal Army Pay Corps, Territorial Army and Volunteer Reserve, attached to B Company of the Northumbrian Volunteers based in Kendal, I was part of a group from the company tasked to provide communications cover for the event, which was taking place over a sizeable area of the estate. I and a couple of colleagues were manning the base station situated in the centre of the course in an elevated position in the grounds of the estate. As we were checking the equipment on the Saturday morning before the event started, one of the course marshals came to check on progress. While we were chatting to him, he pointed out a dark-coloured Range Rover with a distinctive registration pulling up at a chicane obstacle which was below our base station position, and remarked that it was the Duke's vehicle. A few minutes later, the vehicle climbed the hill, and His Royal Highness got out and came over to talk to us, asking who we were and what we were doing. As the NCO in charge of the party, it fell to me to salute him and explain our role. He was very interested and spoke quite informally to everybody, expressing the wish that everything would go well for the competition and our small part in it. The exchange only lasted for a brief time, but the marshal commented to me afterwards that, the previous evening, the Duke had attended a briefing for all the drivers involved and had just taken his seat quietly and listened to the instructions for the event without fuss or ceremony. It made a lasting memory, of which the key factor for me was that I had had the opportunity to salute him personally, face to face, and to have that salute acknowledged. Worshipful Brother John L. Dixon, Past Provincial Deputy Grand Registrar, Johnstonian Lodge No. 9301, Province of Durham.
My experience took place many years ago in Sheffield when Prince Philip opened a sewage works there. After performing the opening, he turned to his audience, and with a huge grin on his face, he went on as follows: "My family are very good at openings. We open all manner of things, hospitals, bridges, public buildings, for instance. There are so many openings that we have a rota for these duties so that we all take our turn. Now, I don't know who is responsible for drawing up that rota, but I can guarantee, strangely enough, that whenever there's a sewage works to open, my name is always at the top of the rota. This produced hoots of appreciative laughter from his audience. Prince Philip wished us all well and went on his way, still grinning. And that's from Brother David Moore, PPRJGD, of the Albrick Festival Lodge, number 9576, province of Shropshire.
Between 2002 and 2006, I ran a small craft brewery in the West Highlands of Scotland. In the summer of 2005, Her Majesty the Queen and His Royal Highness the Prince Philip paid a visit to the village where I had my business, to visit the brewery and the neighbouring ice wall and climbing centre. Both of our royal guests and Her Majesty's Lord Lieutenant for Inverness were, of course, charming, engaging, and an absolute pleasure to host. But my young brewers were nervous at the arrival of our guests. Prince Philip clearly recognised this, left the rest of the party, came up to them and started cracking jokes, asking them if they really drank our beer or preferred supermarket lager, and put them at their ease. The Duke was on his hands and knees underneath the bar with one of my young colleagues, asking how the casks and the hand pumps and the dispense system all worked. I think he and they loved it. Neil Cotton, Apollo University Lodge number 357, Lodge of Assistance number 2773, Tivoli Libris Lodge number 2150.
My memory of Prince Philip is from the opening of a building in Plymouth many years ago. It was pouring with rain. Everyone was getting wet, and it was his turn to speak. He just said, "I'm now supposed to give a speech. You're all getting wet, so I will not bother you with my speech. Let's go inside and eat the grub that's been provided." And that's from Richard Howard of Lodge 5496.
In 1969/70, when I was manager at Stornoway Airfield, I met Prince Philip when he was passing through to the USA. It was an awful day and he didn't want to leave the aircraft. He asked me what I was doing, and I said I was due to pick up my wife and newborn daughter from the hospital. His retort was, "Good God, man, she's more important than me. Go and pick her up." A year later, he was passing through again, and his first words were, "How's your wife and daughter?" I couldn't believe it. When you think of all the people he would have met. John Fox.
David F. Thompson writes, "I was at the Holker Hall in the Lake District in about 1978 for their annual country fair, with all manner of country stalls as well as carriage driving competitions. It was a bitterly cold day with a really stiff breeze and occasional drizzle falling. I'd taken refuge in the beer tent with my wife and two young children and had just ordered, and had to instruct the barman in the making of, hot toddies. As I was sipping the steaming glass, I heard a voice over my shoulder. 'That looks inviting. What have you got there, young man?' I thought I slightly recognised the voice, but couldn't place it, and turned, half expecting to see an old golfing friend. You can imagine my surprise when I turned round to see His Royal Highness dressed in a long, light-coloured mackintosh and a bowler hat, looking inquisitively at my glass. Words nearly failed me, but I blurted out, "Hot toddy, sir." "Ooh, that sounds good," he said, turning to the bar. "We'll have a few of those," he suggested, with flunkies almost fighting with each other to get to the bar. He turned to me and winked and made my day, mainly as I now had a story I could relate to for the rest of my life. And that's from David F. Thompson, the past Provincial Grand Superintendent of Works at Acacia Lodge, number 4512, Liverpool Masonic Hall.
I was on duty as a police civilian security officer at the Palace of Westminster in the early 1990s when Prince Philip was due to give a talk to a small number of people in the Chumley Room. This was not an official meeting. He drove into the Royal Court in an early version of an electric car, accompanied by his protection officer and followed by an unmarked police vehicle. In he went. Some 45 minutes later, he came out alone, passed me, gave me a wave, and got in his car and drove off. Some few minutes later, three police officers came running out and stared at the empty space. I couldn't help it. I said, "He went that way," pointing my finger. I never saw any other car leave the Royal Court at such speed in the rest of my career as then. I had to smile. David Sharman, Eastgate Lodge No. 6694, Halsey Masonic Hall, Cheshunt, Broxbourne, Hertfordshire.
This next section is the news and views from the provinces. But before we start with those, there's an article called Join the Jabs Army. We're inviting all Freemasons to volunteer for our vaccination drive. Could you help out in your local community? United Grand Lodge of England, UGLE, is encouraging its 200,000 members to roll up their sleeves and volunteer to assist in vaccinating the population. To help protect all UK citizens during this time, Freemasons have also offered their lodges to aid in administering the vital jabs, and many buildings are being used in COVID-19 vaccination centres. In Hertfordshire, Halsey Hall is being used as a vaccination centre and supporting three local GP surgeries. The centre has been operational since January, and once fully scaled, there'll be up to 1,000 vaccinations given each day. NHS frontline staff members are also administering the jabs at the Masonic Building in Essex. Meanwhile, Freemasons in South Wales opened the doors of Barry Masonic Hall to local medical practices from the 21st of January. In addition, two halls are being used as vaccination centres in West Kent. At the Westwood Masonic Centre in Welling, more than 2,000 people were vaccinated on the 9th and 10th of January, while the Tunbridge Wells Masonic Centre was a welcome venue for vaccinations on the 14th of January. UGLE is also encouraging Freemasons to donate their time to help fight the virus. However, it emphasised that any volunteers should not participate if they're in an at-risk group. Freemason Alec Hurley is a retired RAF senior medical officer and a self-employed medical examiner for the Civil Aviation Authority. During these difficult times, he's back on duty, working 12-hour shifts three times a week for clinical COVID-19 assessment and as a clinical supervisor at the Stevenage Superhub for vaccinations. Freemasons are volunteering across many provinces. They're assisting at vaccination sites in Devon, Lincolnshire, Leicester and Wiltshire. In Dorset, they're driving ambulances and working as volunteer vaccinators. More than 100 Freemasons from Northamptonshire and Huntingdonshire have volunteered with St John Ambulance to help the NHS vaccination team. The charity is providing training for the volunteers, while the Freemasons have made their buildings available to the St John's logistics team. Over in Cheshire, Freemasons are working with the Clinical Commissioning Group to provide the local Masonic Hall as a vaccination hub to protect patients. The UGLE campaign is being carried out through its monthly email to members and official social media channels. The idea is to reach as many members as possible to encourage them to help immunise the population. Dr. David Staples, Chief Executive of UGLE, said, "In 2018, more than 18.5 million hours of volunteer work were undertaken by Freemasons. Now that we have the vaccine in the UK, it is crucial that we help in every way we can to protect the population. If the NHS needs people, then we are happy to encourage and emphasise the importance of this to our members. We want to support the NHS and show our gratitude for its people's efforts and the amazing job they have done during the pandemic. Freemasons always stand behind our core values of friendship, integrity, charity and respect, and we are proud to help so many people." According to the NHS, more than 6 million people had received a vaccine by the 28th of January. Britain's ordered 140 million vaccine doses, enough to protect the entire population. But the NHS faces a race against time to protect everyone before a possible new wave. More than ever, efforts to vaccinate those most at risk from serious illness are now paramount, and there is a need to ensure that the NHS has as many volunteers as possible. To help the NHS in the vaccination campaign, volunteers should sign up at the following website, nhsvolunteerresponders.org.uk. Volunteers will then receive an email with login details to sign up online and be asked to download the Good Sam app, which will match them to their area. And now the rest of the out and about articles from around the provinces.
Number 1. Sussex. Search and rescue. Lives may be saved at sea thanks to a donation of 33 fire tablet devices by Sussex Freemasons. The tablets will be distributed among the 8 RNLI lifeboat stations across the county. Together with 12 devices supplied earlier in the year to the 2 RNLI stations in Eastbourne, the 33 tablets are for the use of the crews based at the RNLI lifeboat stations at Rye Harbour, Hastings, Eastbourne, Newhaven, Brighton, Shoreham, Littlehampton, and Selsey. The tablets will help crew members with remote online training and to practice their core skills. Lewis Arnold, coxswain and mechanic of the Newhaven-based all-weather 7-class lifeboat, whose crews have been awarded 19 medals for gallantry, said, "On behalf of all the lifeboat stations in Sussex, I would like to say thank you to Sussex Freemasons. COVID-19 cancelled all of our physical training sessions. The gift of the 33 tablets lets us keep training online, running rescue scenarios based on historic calls that we have attended, and keeping our core skills at a high level, ensuring we are as ready as possible to keep saving lives at sea." Sussex Masonic Charitable Foundation Chairman Michael Harris said, "As Sussex Freemasons, we are proud to be able to support the work of the RNLI at each of the 8 lifeboat stations along the beautiful Sussex coast. It's so important that crew members can stay connected and practice the vital skills that preserve lives at sea. We hope that these tablets will play a part in assisting them in their selfless work."
Number 2 is Essex. Come together when Worshipful Brother Elaine Malone, Deputy Grand Secretary of the Order of Women's Freemasons, OWF, saw an Essex provincial tweet about their Shoebox 500 challenge, she contacted Chris Hicks of Thomas Ralling Lodge, number 2508, to see if they could also raise funds to help the homeless. Chris is responsible for events, PR and communications at Loughton Masonic Centre, where Elaine's own OWF Lodge Diligence, number 179 meets. The Deputy Provincial Grand Master in charge, Paul Reeves, said he was more than happy for her lodge to get involved. To coordinate, Peter Lowe, the Provincial Communications Officer, asked Ian Graham to be the link man, and he arranged for Lodge Diligence to support his Chafford Lodge, number 5510, Shoebox 500 team. The lady members of Lodge Diligence raised £150, which Elaine used to buy drinks, shampoos, body lotion, deodorant, tissues, wet wipes and female hygiene products. Another member, Eileen Coles, also in Lodge Diligence, Margaret Gibson, a past assistant grand director of ceremonies, and the lady member of her two lodges also joined in. Colchester Priory, number 155, collected a range of items, and Obedience, number 364, raised £90 to add to those that had been put together. Lodge Diligence, number 179, supports events at Loughton Masonic Centre, and the OWF supports county shows, freshers' fairs, and had a stand at the open house event at UGLE. "It's all about getting involved," said Elaine, who also works to encourage new and young members to join the OWF, stating they are the future of Freemasonry.
Number 3. Shropshire. Small comforts. In Shropshire, as elsewhere, Easter isn't an easy time for many young people, such as those in hospital, a refuge, or temporary accommodation. Children forced to leave abusive homes have to move quickly, sometimes far from home, school, and friends. For them, as for children in hospital or with life-limiting illnesses, a little joy can go a long way. Thanks to the support of Morrisons, Shropshire Libraries, and many individual members, Shropshire Freemasons have made a difference. They responded to a call from Provincial Grand Master Roger Pemberton to raise funds for those in need. Morrisons supplied Easter eggs at a huge discount, while Shropshire Libraries provided age-appropriate books. As a result, 245 Easter goodie bags were delivered by the PGM and his wife, along with David Purslow, Shropshire's Provincial Education Officer, to Shropshire Council's Temporary Accommodation Office, the STAY Project, in Oakengates, supporting homeless young people in Telford, the Telford and Wrekin Council Domestic Abuse Support Unit, the PRH Children's Ward at Telford's Princess Royal Hospital, and Hope House Children's Hospice in Oswestry. Roger Pemberton said, "This is the first time we have given away Easter eggs and books to help make some lives a little better. We can make it a regular event.
For number four, we go to Suffolk, on the scent. The province of Suffolk is donating funds to the charity Medical Detection Dogs. The charity's dogs are specially trained to detect the odour of human disease, with the aim of developing faster, more efficient and less invasive diagnostics. Rick Orme, the provincial grand charity steward for the province of Suffolk, said, "I'm delighted that we're able to offer some support to this fantastic charity, following the presentation by Norma Howell at our Almoners conference. I understand that the charity is also conducting research into whether the detection dogs can assist with the COVID-19 pandemic. I wish them continued success, and I'm delighted to be able to offer some support for their cause." The charity is at the forefront of research into the fight against cancer and other life-threatening diseases such as Parkinson's disease and bacterial infections.
Number 5. Cambridgeshire. Digital donations. Following the funding donation from Cambridgeshire Freemasons for more than 120 Raspberry Pi computers during February, they have now stepped up their support of the Cambridgeshire and Peterborough Digital Drive campaign by donating more than 40 laptops to the Cambridgeshire Youth Panel. This is the second appeal to be initiated by Provincial Grandmaster Bill Daster this year. He challenged members to pass on any unused laptops so that they could be used by young people in the local community. This part of the appeal is being coordinated by Cambridgeshire Freemason Clive Webber, a member of a lodge that meets in Ely. Clive has been collecting the laptops and arranging for them to be processed so that they can be used by young people with little or no access to technology. In Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, more than 8,000 children and young people do not have laptops or personal computers to access lessons, online resources, receive support from their teachers, or interact with their classmates. Digital Drive is working in partnership with Cambridgeshire County Council, Peterborough City Council, Cambridgeshire Youth Panel, Cambridge Digital Partnership, and Cambridge 2030 to make sure that every child across the county can access their schoolwork at home.
Number 6 is Staffordshire. Making connections. A local community group that serves Etruria and Shelton in Stoke-on-Trent is celebrating after securing £2,500 of funding from the National Lottery's Local Connections programme. The Celebration Generation project will help to break down barriers between younger and older generations by helping them to connect through traditional methods such as pen pal letter writing packs, whilst also providing opportunities for young people to buddy up with older residents and help them to embrace new technologies. Etruria Matters was born out of an old residents' association serving Etruria and Shelton. Over the past year, the community group has become well known for the support it offers to residents across all areas of the multi-ethnic and diverse community it serves. During the COVID crisis, many people approached the group because they were struggling to afford to buy food for their families. Matt Crompton from the group secured an agreement with a local co-op store to collect food that would otherwise go to waste and share it with a few families. And so the pantry was born. Claire Bryan, the manager of Freemasons Hall in Shelton, heard about Etruria Matters towards the end of 2020 and contacted the group. She then approached the Freemasons who meet at Shelton. They have so far donated £1,400 to the pantry, and Claire now delivers food weekly to Etruria Matters. The community group is encouraging more residents to get involved.
Number 7. Leicestershire and Rutland. Help at hand. 2,000 children and young people with type 1 diabetes will receive support from an innovative new app that can help manage their condition. This is thanks to a grant of £42,000 from Leicestershire and Rutland Freemasons to the Leicester Hospitals charity. The new mobile education app, known as DEAPP, D-E-A-P-P, has been developed by the Children's Research Centre and aims to educate patients and families through 12 creative and engaging learning sessions that can be played through a smartphone, tablet, or PC. The app provides instant access to online information whenever required, without needing to wait for medical appointments. It is already in use in 28 hospitals across England and Wales, and there are plans to roll it out to every hospital in England and Wales by 2022. The Freemasons' grant will allow the app to be adapted to help patients and families from black and ethnic minorities, where English is not the main language, or for families of patients with learning disabilities. This will be achieved by adding additional modules and components to DApp to provide relevant information, ensuring that all children and young people diagnosed can have equal access to high-quality education about type 1 diabetes. The aim is to translate the app into Welsh, Somali, Punjabi, and Urdu. Beyond that, DApp will be developed to focus on resources for over 16s, specifically in terms of health and well-being, dealing with mental health, risk-taking behaviour, and how this impacts on a young person's diabetes.
Number 8 is South Wales. Mobile support. South Wales Freemasons have donated £25,000 to Hugod, Wales's leading centre for people who are sleeping rough in Cardiff. The money will be used to replace the charity's 15-year-old vehicle. Hugod remains open around the clock. For more than 30 years, it has given people who are homeless and vulnerable the specialist support they need to rebuild their lives for the future. The charity has worked with nearly 900 homeless people since the first of the COVID-19 lockdowns in March 2020, and it fully expects this number to continue rising over the next 12 to 18 months as the number of people in the city facing homelessness increases. Richard Edwards, chief executive of Hugod, said, "As part of the service that Hugod offers, we transport our clients to appointments they need to attend and, before the COVID-19 restrictions, to organised events. Our clients rely heavily on us for this, as most struggle to use public transport because of the cost. It's a situation that has worsened during the pandemic. Our current vehicle has certainly seen better days and has needed to be replaced for a while now. Sadly, we just couldn't afford to do it. We're very grateful to the South Wales Freemasons for their generous grant. A new vehicle will make an enormous difference to us as well as to our services, and it means we can offer so much more to clients."
Number 9. Northants and Hunts. Stepping up. St John Ambulance is seeking volunteers to join the NHS COVID-19 vaccine team, and we are delighted to report that Freemasons have more than 100 volunteers now on standby to assist. The NHS has begun what will be the largest vaccination programme in its history, and Freemasonry has been asked to be part of the team that helps to protect millions of people. St John Ambulance is providing full training, and the initial commitment is for volunteers to be available for at least 2 8-hour shifts each month. In addition, many of the local Masonic centres around the province have made their buildings available to the St John logistics team, and further news in this respect is expected shortly. Assistant Provincial Grandmaster Mark Constance said, "We are incredibly excited about playing our part in the national fight back against COVID-19 and in creating a healthier, safer and more resilient future."
Number 10. Northumberland. Radio Stars. Northumberland Freemasons now have their own radio show. The monthly show, called Sound Level, is hosted by volunteers at community radio station Radio Northumberland as part of their commitment to connecting as many diverse groups across the county as possible during lockdown. Presented by Tom Stewart from Widrington Station and produced by Keith Newman from Oldham, the show looks at the personal stories of Northumberland Freemasons, gives practical information and highlights their charitable work throughout Northumberland, Newcastle and North Tyneside. The 90-minute February show featured an interview with the former guitarist of Hebburn-based 80s band The News, explored the history of the 100-year-old Cramlington Lodge, examined the impact of COVID-19 on farming, and reported on some of the good causes that were the recipients of almost £200,000 in donations in 2020. Stuart Cairns, Provincial Grand Secretary of Northumberland Freemasons, said the radio show will be for Freemasons by Freemasons, but it's hoped that the general public will listen in and enjoy the content. The format will be a mixture of interviews, topics of interest and music. It'll provide an opportunity for Freemasons in Northumberland to share their hobbies with others and discuss those topics and other issues of interest. Tom Stewart added, "COVID-19 has isolated a lot of people, including Freemasons, many of whom are old and vulnerable. We're hoping that this new show will reconnect them with familiar people who have shared interests through the internet wavebands. The show airs on Radio Northumberland Mondays at 1 p.m, Tuesdays at 4 p.m, Thursdays at 6 p.m, and Saturdays at 5 p.m. You can tune in by asking your smart speaker to play Radio Northumberland or search for Radio Northumberland on www.tunein.com or www.internetradiouk.com.
Number 11. Derbyshire. Pass the mic. In a twist on the modern travelling gavel concept, Amadeus Lodge number 9539 is hosting a meeting at which your lodge can claim the travelling headset. To win it, your lodge has to have the largest number of visitors at the meeting. And when you hold another meeting, another lodge has the chance to win it. Andy Glaves and Steve Williams came up with the idea in April 2020 to encourage members to visit other lodges' Zoom meetings and to encourage them to start hosting their own. In the 10 months the headset has been travelling around the province, it has moved between lodges 12 times and has been claimed by 9 different lodges across 7 Masonic centres within Derbyshire. The Zoom meetings have evolved into events, everything from talks on cave rescue and the blood bike service to a lecture on lodge history, a jazz piano performance, and even a pantomime.
And finally, from the group of lodges in the Southwest Pacific, Hurricane Relief. The Lodge of Fiji recently donated school supplies valued at around £5,000. The contribution consisted of uniforms, sandals, exercise books and school accessories and were received by 284 children from 9 schools in the remote islands of southern Laos, part of the Fiji group of islands. The schools were devastated by Tropical Cyclone Harold in February 2020, with buildings destroyed and students losing all their schooling needs. Because of their remoteness, some islands are around 500 nautical miles from the capital Suva and closer to the Tongan island group, and with the ravages to Fiji by Tropical Cyclone Yasa in December 2020, it has taken all this time to get the assistance to the schools so that they were ready for the 2021 school year. The students and head teacher travelled all the way from their islands to attend the handover event in Suva with the Lodge of Fiji Brethren. And there is a photograph accompanying this, showing some people left to right. Worshipful Brother Sitiveni Yakwona, Very Worshipful Brother Ross MacDonald, Worshipful Brother Krishna Raju, and school head teacher from Laos. Now the stories section, people, places, history and more. Starting with Brother on the Beat, Norwell Roberts, QPM on Overcoming Racism in the Force. Getting to Know You, an audience with PGM of South Wales, Gareth Jones, OBE. The Light Blues Brigade, learning and engagement with the New and Young Masons Clubs. And Dr. David Staples' interview, UGLE's Grand Secretary, on taking Freemasonry from the margins to the mainstream.
On page 23, Force for Change. As London's first black police constable in 1967, Freemason Norwell Roberts, QPM, defied racists to rise to the rank of detective sergeant. Peter Watts discovers how he blazed a trail for future officers. On Norwell Roberts' first day as Metropolitan Police PC 590 C Division, he walked into Bow Street Police Station to meet his reporting sergeant. It was 1967, and Norwell had just become the Met's first black police officer. What should have been a moment of great pride was defined by what happened next. The sergeant told me, "Look, you N-word, I'll see to it that you never pass your probation," recalls Norwell, now long retired from the Met and an active Freemason. "I was a 21-year-old, straight out of training school. I'd been working at a university with people from all over the world, so having that said to me on the first day was an eye-opener." The reporting sergeant couldn't stop Norwell from passing his probation, but he did help make his life hell for years, and he wasn't the only one. Now living in northwest London, Norwell relates a litany of daily indignities inflicted on him by fellow officers. He was spat on, tea was thrown at him, and buttons were torn off his uniform. Matchsticks were stuffed in the keyhole of his car. Racial epithets were used frequently. Once he was patrolling Covent Garden on foot when officers hurled racial abuse at him from a passing patrol car in front of members of the public. The most shocking moment came in 1971. Michael Ince had become the Met's second black male police officer in 1970, but tragically died in a car crash in February 1971 while responding to an emergency call. A bloke in Bow Street was waving a newspaper around shouting, "One down, two to go," says Norwell. That was the way it was. Norwell joined the police force almost on a whim, applying in response to a newspaper advert in 1965 and then again in 1966 after the initial application was dismissed without explanation. Once accepted, he took it seriously and enjoyed training in Hendon, North London, where there was no inkling of what lay ahead. Like any black Briton of the era, Norwell had experienced racism. He'd moved to England from Anguilla when he was 9 years old to live with his mother in Bromley in South London. Here he encountered older children who dropped him on his head to see the colour of his blood, and a headmistress who wouldn't let him go to grammar school after he passed his 11 plus, as he needed to learn English ways. That was just a way of saying, "Your boy is black, there's no way we are going to send him to a grammar school, as it will look as if he's cleverer than a white boy. That ain't going to happen," says Norwell. Improvements came at secondary school, by which time he had moved to North London. He left school at 15 and earned his City and Guilds while working as a laboratory technician at University College London's Westfield College. That's when he applied to join the Met. Once in the force, he was determined to stick it out despite the prejudice, and moved steadily up the ranks to Detective Sergeant. He relished the public side of policing, finding the public often treated him far better than his colleagues. But night after night, he would return to his lodgings at the police section house and cry. Did he ever complain or confront his tormentors? "Who do I confront? I was on my own. There were 27,000 police officers, and I was the only black one," he says. The one time he did approach a superior officer, it was dismissed. "I thought, I've lost," he says. "I'd let them get to me. I wasn't going to do that again. I left the office and went back about my business. I cried about that. Crying was the only way I could relieve it." Only one officer from that era has apologised directly for their role in the bullying. Norwell joined Freemasonry in much the same cavalier spirit as he had the Met, almost as a lark, with little notion of what he was getting into. He soon found himself deeply committed to the craft, loving the ceremony and the friendly, welcoming atmosphere. That was in 1985, and he is now the Provincial Grand Almoner, as well as the holder of various offices in the craft, Grand Rank in the Mark Degree, the Royal Arch Mariners, Grand Rank in the Royal Arch, and the Royal and Select Master. Before lockdown, he found himself attending as many as 6 meetings a week. During COVID, when it was at its height, I made 15 to 20 phone calls every day. I still make at least 10 a day to support those who are elderly or scared. It's clear that Freemasonry appeals to that discipline. Norwell sleeps for just 3 hours a night, rising at 3:30 a.m., and love of public service that made him such an effective copper. He acknowledges the parallels. Even ritual has some similarities with his old life. "I used to enjoy going to court when I was in the police force, and it's like that," he says. "It's like being a thespian. You can put so much into it." For his pioneering role in British policing, Norwell has received the Queen's Police Medal, which was presented to him by Prince Charles at Buckingham Palace in 1996. When a new police museum opens on the site of his old police station in Bow Street, the story of Norwell Roberts will feature prominently. He is rightfully proud of his accomplishments and still appears in recruitment campaigns by the Met. And he has no regrets about that off-the-cuff decision to become a policeman more than 50 years ago. Somebody had to go through what he experienced if the barrier was to be broken. "I'd do it all again," he says. "They were never going to beat me. They were never going to win. I needed those tests to see what I was made of. It was a test of character, and I believed I passed. I am proud of lots of things I achieved. I was the first black police officer, and I was the first black man to do 30 years in the force. I got the Queen's Police Medal. I have the Police Long Service and Good Conduct Medal. And I did it all at the sharp end."
And at the bottom of the page, there is a list of Norwell's distinctions.
A Worshipful Brother. Almoner in 6 other orders. First black man to get the Queen's Police Medal for Distinguished Service. First black man to serve for 30 years in the Met. A training room is named in Norwell's honour at Hendon Training School. Legend Award from the Afro and Caribbean descendants in the UK for selfless and long dedication to the safety of the community as a whole. Legend Award from BBC Radio London.
Roll of Honour. Here we meet Gareth Jones, lifelong civil servant, Provincial Grand Master of South Wales, third Grand Principal and proud recipient of an OBE. Apart from a year as a tennis coach, Gareth Jones has been a member of Her Majesty's Civil Service for the whole of his working life. I started as a computer programmer when computers could easily have taken up a half of a five-a-side football pitch, he says. I've worked as private secretary to a cabinet minister in the Margaret Thatcher government. I've been registrar of companies for the UK. And I finally retired as Director General for Natural Resources in the Welsh Government. I now chair the board of a professional representative body. Now PGM of South Wales and third Grand Principal, Gareth's interest in Freemasonry began in the early 1980s when he was playing rugby for Cardiff High School Old Boys RFC. Quite a few of the members were also in the Old Boys Lodge, Harlequins number 5793 in Cardiff, and they were people I liked and respected. So after some discussions, my brother, Peter, now worshipful brother Peter Jones, PJGD, and I approached one of our friends who was pleased to tell us a bit about it. In February 1984, Peter and I were initiated together, and we were subsequently passed, raised and exalted together too, with Peter, as the older sibling, installing me into the chairs of the lodge and chapter some years later.
What inspires you about Freemasonry?
In my early days in Freemasonry, I was inspired by more senior members, some of whom were pretty good role models. More recently, I have been and continue to be inspired by young men, particularly those in our new and young Masons clubs. These members, with their new, fresh ideas and refreshing attitudes towards the craft and the Royal Arch, are a reminder that we must constantly change to keep up with society, while at the same time holding dear those basic principles and values that encouraged us to join.
Has Freemasonry improved your life?
Apart from the natural improvements that stem from an understanding of what our beautiful ritual has to teach us, Freemasonry has provided a wide circle of friends for my wife and me. It's given us great opportunities to meet new people and enjoy the social aspects of the craft. In my current roles as third Grand Principal and PGM for South Wales, Freemasonry has also provided some much-needed structure since I retired from work full-time.
What do you enjoy most about being third Grand Principal and PGM?
While I still enjoy our ceremonial, I especially like meeting our members across provinces and further afield. I enjoy listening to their views, responding to concerns, making presentations at annual meetings, and generally playing a small part in spreading good practice when and wherever I can.
How has the pandemic presented challenges for Freemasonry?
This last year has been like no other. Our inability to meet and to enjoy the organisations we love so much has been heartbreaking, frustrating and downright horrid. Freemasonry has, however, continued. We don't suddenly become non-Masons simply because we can't meet. We must all have been heartened to learn about the wonderful work our members have done to help and support members and wider communities in their times of need. Freemasonry will continue stronger and better in the months and years to come.
Tell us about receiving your OBE.
Well, I was honoured to receive my OBE in 2003 from His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales as a result of when I was Operations Director for Wales during the foot and mouth crisis. The day at the palace was a lovely experience for my family and me. We got to meet Sir Mick Jagger, who was receiving his knighthood, and Jerry Marsden, who was receiving his MBE.
Hopes for the future of Freemasonry?
I'm a bit of a traditionalist, so my hopes for the future are pretty modest. I hope and trust we will never compromise on our underlying values and principles, and that our ceremonies will continue to teach us lessons that have stood the test of time over 300 years. Of course, we must adapt our practices to suit society around us if we're to remain relevant. But those adaptations must be done via evolution rather than revolution if we're to keep our older members engaged and supportive. After all, they are the ones who have acted as stewards of Freemasonry before our time, and we must be sensitive to their needs always. On a more personal note, I have a son who is a new Master Mason and who probably thinks it's perfectly normal for the Deputy Grand Master, Second Grand Principal and Past Assistant Grand Master to attend one's initiation. He's about to be exalted into the Royal Arch. I look forward to seeing his progress.
What's the best bit of advice you've been given?
Best bit of advice? Rule one, there is always a solution to any problem. Rule two, if you can't find the solution, refer to rule one.
What are your favourite ways to relax?
My wife and I love holidays, especially our annual skiing trip. Since lockdown, I've restarted my interest in playing chess and play once or twice a day against opponents across the globe. And as restaurants open again, my love of fine dining and good wines can once again be satisfied.
On page 28, Light Blues Brigade. The New and Young Masons Club, NYMC, explains how they offer younger members Masonic learning and engagement with the craft. Dedicated to offering advice on the running and setup of New and Young Masons, both in the UK and internationally, the New and Young Masons Club, NYMC, acts as a conduit between these clubs and the United Grand Lodge of England, UGLE. Each year, the NYMC hosts a conference organised by a different club in their own province. Here, a network of committee members from groups far and wide gather to discuss the important issues within their organisations. The sharing of ideas on best practice, learnings to enhance retention and engagement with the wider membership, is always on the agenda. The NYMC has successfully supported 5 conferences with different clubs hosting each time. These events have attracted rulers of the craft as keynote speakers, providing interesting insight into UGLE and its future. Last year's conference was cancelled due to the pandemic, but the Fleet House Light Blues Club of Hertfordshire is hoping to host one in October 2021. The theme of their conference is Engaging Your Membership, where they will showcase speakers from the marketing industry. This will be a fantastic opportunity for clubs to meet and discuss their successes and challenges throughout the pandemic and beyond. Most provinces and districts now have a New and Young Masons Club. These increase involvement with Freemasonry and help engage members of the craft. Although each club is different, most will offer opportunities for Masonic learning, visitation, and social events. The key to their success is that members can connect with the wider fraternity, sharing experiences with those who are typically at a similar stage of their Masonic journey. The need for New and Young Masons clubs has become clear, and in the last 10 years we have seen a surge in club inaugurations. Many New and Young Masons clubs provide a platform for potential members to ask questions before joining. There is also the opportunity to invite wives, partners, family and friends to specific events, which helps build Freemasonry within each community. Formed in 2016, the NYMC has helped many provinces start groups and provided support where needed. Worshipful Brother Mitchell Merrick Thirlway was the founder of the NYMC and had single-handedly run the organisation until recently. In 2021, the NYMC Working Group was formed. This is made up of 6 members from different clubs, each taking an area of responsibility. The working party's aim is to continue uniting all clubs under the same banner and support them with conferences and initiatives. Each one is sovereign and often supported by their provincial executive, so the NYMC acts to provide guidance on best practice, recommended models, and constitutions. Feeding back information to UGLE is an important part of the NYMC role. Having been invited, 2 members gave a presentation at the European Grand Secretary's meeting this year, hosted virtually from London. Right Worshipful Brother Gareth Jones is the UGLE liaison for the NYMC. He said, "I have been delighted to act as the senior UGLE liaison point with the growing number of New and Young Masons clubs across England and Wales and, recently in some of our districts abroad. Working with newer Freemasons in their conferences, meetings, and other discussions has been a real inspiration and has taught me a great deal about how Freemasonry is perceived by less experienced members. New and young Masons clubs are clearly an important network of like-minded members who can bolster enjoyment of the craft, contribute positively to efforts to retain members, and help to attract new young men to our lodges, ensuring the successful sustainability of the craft for the future. This network of clubs plays an important role in helping Freemasons connect with each other. The social media scene has been alive during the pandemic, with many clubs sharing pictures and videos. In turn, the NYMC has provided a number of online talks and mini-conferences. Topics were varied to appeal to a wide audience of Freemasons keen to learn more. The criteria for joining a club differ in each province. A full list of clubs is available at www.nymc.org.uk.
This next article is entitled Leading Light. In his first 4 years as Grand Secretary, Dr. David Staples' passion for the craft has set him on a quest to modernise Freemasonry while cherishing its core traditions. The sliding doors moment for Dr. David Staples came as he was changing into his robes for his very first meeting as a Freemason. Staples was in his first year at Oxford University, having joined Magdalen College from humble roots in southeast London, and found himself swept into the Apollo Lodge by an enthusiastic housemate. Despite his best efforts, he still didn't have a good idea about what Freemasonry was actually about, and he began to wonder what he was doing. "I remember I was getting changed and started thinking, do I really want to do this?" He recalls almost 30 years later, "I was in half a mind to go home. It's amazing how these little decisions affect your life. I had no idea then what an impact it would have on my life." That's an understatement. Dr. Staples, now 46, soon became absorbed in the craft, developing parallel careers in the NHS and Freemasonry as he moved around the country, from Oxford to Bath to Nottingham and then Peterborough, with a year in Australia. In the medical world, he became a clinical director, while in Freemasonry, he made it to Deputy Grand Director of Ceremonies. Then, at a dinner in London, he received a tap on the shoulder. Somebody said to me, "What about Grand Secretary?" And my reply was, "Well, I don't know him terribly well, but he seems like a nice chap." It soon became clear that Dr. Staples was being invited to apply for the role. In 2017, following a rigorous 9-month interview process, he was appointed both Grand Secretary and the UGLE's first Chief Executive. This was a new role designed to help modernise the processes of Freemasonry without impacting its history. It's an approach that seemed to sit well with Dr. Staples' ability to combine tradition with modernity. The hallway of his Victorian home features contemporary art alongside hunting scenes, while the landscaped garden contains a section of solar panels. Dr. Staples is a music lover, and one room boasts a baby grand piano, a Victorian pump organ, and a curious 8-horned trumpet he bought as a joke for his wife. He's an occasional lodge organist, and one perk of his job is that when everybody else has gone home, he can have a quick play of the organ in Grand Temple at Freemasons Hall. In the dining room at home sits a completed 750-piece jigsaw depicting Bernard Picart's Masonic Lodge Board at Freemasons Hall, which is a sign of how some members of the household have spent their lockdown. It's doubtful whether Dr. Staples himself has found the time so vigorously as he set about transforming UGLE while working occasional shifts at his local hospital and assisting with the odd bout of homeschooling. He set himself two targets when he took the job. One was to modernise processes to reduce form filling, something that will be completed with the rollout of Hermes. The other was to rehabilitate the image of Freemasonry among the public. Although he had never hidden his own love of Freemasonry from colleagues, he was frustrated that negative messages and conspiracy theories continued to circulate widely. When The Guardian published an article revealing the existence of secret lodges in Westminster packed with MPs and journalists, he launched Operation Enough is Enough. The reality was that both these lodges had been mentioned in the newspapers when they opened, had no active MPs or journalists, and met in Camden, he said. That gave us the ability to lodge a formal complaint. We took out full-page adverts in newspapers, and I did 26 interviews in one day. That was the line in the sand. The membership knew we were standing up for them after they'd been kicked around and misrepresented. It was partly about galvanising them, saying you can't speak nonsense about Freemasonry, and we're giving fair warning to the press that Freemasons were not an easy touch. Aware that such an approach could only be used sparingly before losing impact, UGLE's campaign then took a different line, arguing for greater transparency to remove suspicion while promoting Masonic contributions to charities and good causes. This accelerated during the pandemic when Freemasons raised hundreds of thousands of pounds, earning widespread praise. We are now in a transitional period, he says, where we get an awful lot of good press, but the first sentence is always a caveat, says Dr. Staples. In 18 months, I think that will change and the past will be the past. Recent polling shows impressive results, with Freemasonry increasing 25 points in net favourability over the last 2 years and scoring particular gains in the under-50s. Dr. Staples feels this can increase, and he makes a passionate case for Freemasonry's place in the modern world. This is an organisation that has a purpose in modern society which no other organisation really fulfils, he says. Traditional spirituality is on the decline, but we teach important principles while allowing you to have a really good time. We've been doing ecumenical, multiracial, multi-religion, multi-background stuff for centuries. Freemasonry was the first organisation ever to have one man, one vote. We were one of the first organisations to provide free healthcare for the public. The fundamental principles of the European Enlightenment spread through Freemasonry from country to country, Grand Lodge to Grand Lodge. These were revolutionary social principles that are now entirely absorbed within democracy. For Dr. Staples, the pleasures of Freemasonry became clear when he left Oxford and was invited to join Middlesex Lodge No. 143 in London, his home lodge. Here he encountered Freemasons of diverse age and occupation, whose knowledge and life experiences he could absorb. As time went on, new faces became old friends, providing a reassuring sense of familiarity. A lodge meeting became a place where he could forget about the operating room or the latest NHS restructuring. His love of Freemasonry runs deep and connects with his own character. He speaks eloquently and succinctly about the core philosophical messages of Freemasonry, the three lessons imparted through ritual that he feels cannot be contested by anybody. So, as someone who believes passionately in doing his part to make the world a better place, he leapt at the chance to lead UGLE. Many might consider being a doctor in the NHS close to the pinnacle of public service, but Dr. Staples felt like a moth in a monolith. As Grand Secretary, he could create positive change on a larger scale. As a doctor, I'm not convinced that I was making a lot of difference, whereas working for an organisation that is values-based and rehabilitates that in the public mind, that really does make a difference. Just look at the COVID-19 initiatives. These are big projects that make a difference to tens of thousands of lives. That's something that Freemasonry has been doing under the radar for a very long time. His time is occupied with helping draft the UGLE's strategy for the next 5 years, starting in 2022, which will continue to build on progress made since 2017, elevating Freemasonry from the margins into the mainstream. I am working every hour God sends, but I enjoy it, he says. It feels important, which is in line with the message at the Masonic core, doing something for the right reasons. This next section is a daily advancement, extending knowledge of Freemasonry. And in this article, there's one article in the section, Advancing the Craft, Dr. Rick Berman details the life of John Montagu, 2nd Duke of Montagu, on the tercentenary of his appointment as the first noble Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of England.
The nomination and installation of John Montagu, 1690 to 1749, the first nobleman to become Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of England, marked the beginning of Freemasonry's ascent to the heights of 18th century English, as well as European and American, society. It was a testament to Montagu's prestige that significant numbers of aristocrats followed him into Freemasonry, and the more middling followed in their tens of thousands as the century progressed. Montagu's nomination as Grand Master in March 1721 was a turning point in Freemasonry's public persona. It underpinned Grand Lodge's authority over the growing number of lodges in London and provincial England and elsewhere, including Britain's growing American colonies. Before 1721, the annual Grand Feast was on a sufficiently small scale to have taken place in the long room above a London tavern. But in June that year, with Montagu about to be installed at the head of the Society of Freemasons, the event was moved from the Goose and Gridiron in St. Paul's Churchyard to the nearby Stationers' Hall in order to accommodate the many hundreds who now wished to attend. The 1723 Constitutions recorded the occasion, James Anderson noting that "Noblemen and gentlemen of the best rank, with clergymen and learned scholars of most professions and denominations, have joined and submitted to take the charges and to wear the badges of a free and accepted Mason, under our present worthy Grand Master, the most noble Prince John, Duke of Montagu." Montagu's decision to accept the role of Grand Master not only validated Freemasonry, but also added to its appeal. It suggested that the craft was morally and politically sound, fashionable, and fun. With Montagu on board, the installation and feast also received widespread publicity, with press reports in many of London's newspapers and in the provincial and overseas press. Montagu was an excellent choice as Grand Master. Intelligent, wealthy, and exceptionally well-connected, he was the only surviving son of Ralph Montagu, the first Duke, and Elizabeth Risley, the daughter of the 4th Earl of Southampton, a former Lord High Treasurer. Ralph Montagu had been England's ambassador to France, where he had witnessed the persecution of the Huguenots, French Protestants, at first hand. The experience affected him deeply, and he became a great supporter of the French and other Protestants driven to England by the tyranny of their princes, and an admirer of learning and learned men. His son, John, shared a similar outlook. Not only had he been surrounded by Huguenot friends and family at Broughton Hall, the family home, but his maternal grandmother, Rachel de Massieu, had been a Huguenot aristocrat. Henri de Massieu, 2nd Marquis de Ruvigny, 1648 to 1720, later the Earl of Galway, another leading Huguenot and one of William III's principal military commanders, was his second cousin. That several leading Huguenots, not least the Reverend Dr. Jean Theophilus de Saguilier, were at the helm of the new Grand Lodge was no coincidence. Montagu made an ideal figurehead for Freemasonry, and his court connections, interest in the sciences, he was a Fellow of the Royal Society and the Royal College of Physicians, among others, and military titles, acted as a beacon to attract others from those circles. He was also a celebrity figure. Montagu's day-to-day activities featured regularly in the press, with stories ranging from the reportage of major events, such as his loyal address to George I and his role as chief mourner at the funeral of his father-in-law, the Duke of Marlborough, to the offer of a large reward for the return of his wife's lost pet dog. He was also one of the wealthiest men in England, with an annual income of some £20,000, around £4.5 million in today's money, from property rents alone. He financed the settlement of St. Lucia and St. Vincent in the West Indies, the islands having been granted to him in January 1722. And the dowry for his youngest daughter, Mary, on her marriage to Lord Brudenell, was said to be £25,000. Montagu had a close association with the royal family throughout his life and was an avid supporter of George I and the Hanoverian line. He succeeded his father as Master of the Great Wardrobe, a sinecure that paid more than £3,000 a year, officiated as Lord High Constable at George I's 1714 coronation, and carried the sceptre at George II's coronation in 1727. His loyalty was rewarded in 1718 with the Order of the Garter, then, as now, the highest honour in England, and with his appointment in 1725 as Grand Master of the newly revived Order of the Bath. He was raised to the Privy Council in 1736. Montague was also a prominent military figure and held positions that were not merely honorific or a consequence of his position as the Duke of Marlborough's son-in-law. He lobbied actively to be appointed to active posts and raised and financed his own regiments of horse and foot. He was captain and colonel of His Majesty's own troop of horse guards, the 1st Life Guards, the army's premier cavalry regiment, and was promoted Major General in 1735, Lieutenant General in 1739, and Master General of the Ordnance in 1740, a cabinet position with responsibility for the artillery. The 1723 Constitutions, the underpinning of modern Freemasonry, was produced under Montague's auspices and is dedicated to him. He appears on the frontispiece of the book in ducal regalia, presenting the roll of constitutions and a set of compasses to Philip, Duke of Wharton, his successor as Grand Master. At the end of his term, the London Journal, 30th of June 1722, commented that membership of the society had risen to some 4,000, an astonishing achievement if accurate, and a testament to the impact made by Montague in just a year.
Page 40 starts the Grand Lodge, News from Great Queen Street section. We've got three articles. First of all, Quarterly Communication, the wonderful work of Freemasons in their communities. And then the Solomon Sessions, a four-week series of webinars and online resources. And then Word of Mouth, Generous Dentist Bartholomew Ruspini at Freemasons Hall. The future is bright. In his spring message, pro-Grandmaster Peter Lowndes celebrates the wonderful work that Freemasons are doing in their communities. He writes, "The early months of the year are behind us, and I suspect that we're all delighted about that. Spring usually brings some hope in our gardens, and thoughts turn to getting the lawnmower out. I hope I also detect rather more optimism in the fight against COVID, and perhaps our Masonic thoughts can turn to meeting again in some sort of meaningful way. We have to put up with the inevitable doom mongers who'll talk about nothing except a third wave. I'm not naive enough to consider that we have the virus beaten, but I do believe we have found a way to live with and have some measure of control of it, which will enable us to get back to a rather more normal way of life. That can include our Freemasonry, which has an important part to play in so many of our lives. Of course, it's well documented that Freemasons have had an important part to play in the lives of so many fellow Freemasons and non-Masons alike over the past year. This has been enhanced by the generally positive coverage that we've received, both nationally and locally, for all the wonderful work that our members have done. And this is by no means limited to financial donations. There are far too many instances to even begin to mention, and as Freemasons, we're more interested in carrying out this work than craving credit for it. However, it does make a huge difference when we do get some positive press. If we've learned nothing else during this pandemic, we have vastly improved our method of communication, both within the organisation, member to member, lodge to lodge, as well as externally. This has not only been extremely noticeable at the centre here in Freemasons Hall, but also in our provinces and districts, which have all embraced the importance of this aspect. I would add that this process had started well before the pandemic arrived, but the trials and tribulations of the past year have made it all the more evident. Brethren, for the second year in a row, there was no investiture meeting at the end of April. This means that the grand offices of the year who were invested by letter last April will have had no opportunity to act in their office. Not surprisingly, the Grand Master decided that it was right that those who wished to continue in office for the coming year should be allowed to do so. The majority have taken up that offer. I'm confident that during the next year they will get a chance to don their chains and process into Grand Lodge. It may have to be done differently to normal, certainly at first, but let's all be positive and look forward to the Grand Temple being used again in all its glory. I'm going to tempt fate by saying that I very much hope to be able to address a reasonable gathering at some point in June.
On page 42, Learnings Online. The learning and development team's worshipful brother, Nick Brown, describes Solomon Fellowcraft Onboarding, a series of sessions for fellowcrafts to discuss, debate, and speculate. What is onboarding? A four-week series of webinars and interactive resources to encourage fellow craft Freemasons to learn about the lessons of the second degree and reflect on what the teachings mean to them. We are all on a journey as we strive to learn and develop in our beloved craft. We know that often we learn best with the support and encouragement of others, in a community we call lodgers. This can be even better when there are opportunities to be more involved and ask questions. The onboarding course was put together with those areas in mind, and the following program of events has been created. The program. Week 1. Setting the scene. Week 2. Webinar. Week 3. Discussion panel. Week 4. Reflection and participant empowerment. At every Freemason's initiation, a commitment is made to try and make a daily advancement in Masonic knowledge and perhaps learn something about the history of the fraternity or indeed develop confidence. Solomon is a tool for every Freemason to do just this.
The following page has three anonymous review comments from participants of the course, starting with this one. While I was very disappointed that the virus prevented me from being raised last April, the onboarding has been invaluable in making me focus on this degree that otherwise I'd have probably rushed through to get to the next stage. By going through the details and extra materials and discussions, it's meant more and provided extra understanding that I believe will stand us in good stead for the future. Thanks to all the team for the hard work putting it together and delivering it so well.
I've enjoyed the Fellowcraft onboarding. I like the structure, the progression, and how it encouraged readings and contemplations that I probably would not have otherwise engaged in to this depth. Given that the second degree is normally not paid much attention, it made me ask myself if perhaps lodgers should encourage or require craftsmen to make some form of presentation on their researches and insights into the degree before progressing to the third. It could be a short reflection in lodge or at the festive board, written or oral, just something to gently encourage some reflection on it to appreciate the degree.
And finally, while being unable to join the live webinars due to attempting to negotiate bedtime for a 3- and 1-year-old, I have very much enjoyed the learning afforded by this course. I do wish a similar course was available as an entered apprentice and am delighted to hear that it's in the works. I would go so far as to suggest that to enhance new initiates' engagement with Freemasonry at an early stage, an onboarding course on Solomon should be encouraged. Thank you, worshipful brother Nick Brown and the team, for the time and effort put into this course. And then there are details underneath how to register. You can register by going to solomon.ugle.org.uk, putting it into the browser address bar on your computer. You'll not be able to find Solomon by searching for it on Google or the search line of your browser. Solomon is not registered on search engines and is only accessible directly from the address. Here it is again, solomon.ugle.org.uk. On the front page, there is Getting Started with Solomon, a module that's open to everyone and provides details of how to use the system, as well as help videos, quick start guides, and a link to create an account on Solomon that will take you through the simple process of registration. Fill in your details, and once you've received the confirmation email, log in, select your first module, and enrol. If you're using a smartphone, you may want to download the free Adobe Acrobat Reader app first, as this will ensure that the PDFs used on Solomon retain their format.
On page 44, The Beneficent Brother. Archivist and records manager Susan Snell celebrates the life of Bartholomew Ruspini, Freemasonry's generous dentist, and the subject of the Museum of Freemasonry's new exhibition. Everyone at the Museum of Freemasonry is looking forward to welcoming you back with an exciting new exhibition celebrating the groundbreaking Freemason, dentist and philanthropist Bartholomew Ruspini. Born in 1730 in Italy, Ruspini joined Freemasonry in Bristol and went on to make friends at all levels of society. After settling in London, where he established a successful dental practice in the 1760s, Ruspini joined several lodges and chapters, helping to form the Lodge of the Nine Muses and the Prince of Wales Lodge. He transformed 18th century dental care, providing free tooth powder and mouthwash to poor Londoners. He also gave out a styptic to stop the bleeding often caused by backstreet dentistry. Ruspini then established a charity to help the families of Freemasons who were out of work through unemployment or illness. It remains active more than 200 years after his death. His contribution to society was recognised by the Pope, who made him a knight, or chevalier, in 1789. While caring for the Masonic Charitable Foundation's MCF, the Freemasons charity, records, I wanted to celebrate the personality and achievements of this family man, whose legacy continues to influence Freemasonry. An enthusiastic Freemason, Ruspini founded a school for the daughters of members, known today as the Royal Masonic School for Girls. He also set up an annual fundraising event, the origins of the present-day charity festival scheme. Minute books from the Prince of Wales Lodge, Grand Master's Lodge and Chapter of St. James reveal Ruspini's interest in Freemasonry. He helped others from his homeland to settle in London. In recognition of these acts and following him being made a Chevalier by the Pope, local newspapers nicknamed him the Duke of Tuscany. Ruspini encouraged musicians, artists and sculptors to join the Lodge of the Nine Muses. At his Pall Mall home, Ruspini entertained lavishly and was painted by several contemporary artists, including John Russell. After his extraordinary balsamic styptic stopped a violent nosebleed and thereby saving the Grand Master's life, Ruspini was appointed Surgeon Dentist to the Prince of Wales in 1786. Now moving in elevated circles, Ruspini's A Treatise on the Teeth revolutionised dental care and treatment, as he was the first author in Britain to mention children's teething problems, the effect of venereal diseases, and sugar causing abscesses. A Treatise on the Teeth is one of the fascinating items loaned for this exhibition, which also features a fine mahogany travelling case with Ruspini's coat of arms from the Surgeons' Hall Museums, Edinburgh. This luxurious item is one of only two examples known to survive, and includes bottles that once contained Ruspini's mouthwash, tooth powder, and styptic. Other unique items on display include a minute book on loan from Bath's Royal Cumberland Lodge, which Ruspini attempted but failed to join in 1761. There is also correspondence from the museum's archives. A letter from the Royal Academy's archives written by Mrs. Elizabeth Ruspini suggesting the artist Ozias Humphrey could buy the styptic in India, and an early toothbrush made for patients. After Ruspini's death in 1813, James Bladen Ruspini inherited the Chevalier title and secret styptic recipe, but little money due to his father's generosity. In an ironic twist, James Bladen was declared bankrupt in the late 1820s, with his daughters attending the Freemason school founded by their grandfather. Today, Bartholomew Ruspini's legacy is commemorated by a memorial plaque in St. James's Church, Piccadilly, Ruspini Mark Lodge No. 363. Accommodation for young people studying or working in London, and Ruspini House, a preschool at the school's Rickmansworth site, which opened in 2010.
Page 48 begins the Royal Arch section, which is thoughts from the Supreme Grand Chapter. And we've got two articles in this section, starting with the Savage Club chapter, which we'll get to in a moment, and also then Celebrating Golden Moments with Deputy Metropolitan Grand Superintendent Chris Clark. So the first of these two articles, Arts and the Craft, named after a notorious 18th century poet, the Savage Club chapter has revived a time-honoured ritual and is seeing a surge of interest. Throughout the last decade, the Savage Club chapter, number 21290 has built on its considerable heritage and grown to a vibrant, active membership of around 40, most of whom are young professionals. They have their own version of the Royal Arch Ritual, known as Savage Ritual, and have had to hold extra meetings every year to manage demand from those wishing to be exalted into the chapter. We spoke to some of the members involved to get a sense of what has helped make the chapter such a success.
This is from Paul Greer, Scribe E. The History. The Savage Club chapter is attached to the Savage Club Lodge, which was formed off the back of a private members' club called the Savage Club. This is named after the infamous 18th century poet Richard Savage, who was convicted of murder and died in prison of liver failure. The club was founded in 1857 and was famed for its star-studded charity balls at the Royal Albert Hall. It was started by gentlemen who felt that they weren't posh enough to get into the Garrick Club, and remains one of the last bohemian clubs with members drawn from six categories: art, drama, music, literature, law, and science. The lodge was founded in the 1880s on the recommendation of the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VII, who was then Grand Master and a member of the club. The chapter itself was consecrated in 1891. We have had members of some eminence over the years, such as the philanthropist Sir Henry Welcome, who was first principal of the chapter in 1900, and whose past principal's jewel we still possess. There is no requirement for members of the lodge or chapter to be members of the club. They are independent, but we try to stick to the original six categories of club membership. The chapter now meets in the city at Baker's Hall, and we tend to go to the club after dinner for drinks. One prominent member of the chapter was Bernard E. Jones, who was also a member of the club, and who was exalted in the Savage Club chapter in 1913 and installed as first principal in 1925. He wrote the Freemason's Book of the Royal Arch in 1957, which is still generally held to be the definitive explanation of the origin, rise, and development of Royal Arch Freemasonry, and which he dedicated to the Savage Club chapter. I was exalted in the chapter in 2004 and took over as Scribe E in 2012. It's fair to say that the chapter had been struggling for some time. A few of us had been fortunate to be involved in several lodge rescues, specifically the Lodge of Faithful Service and Kensington Lodge, and we were able to bring our experience of those projects to the chapter. We changed the meeting to a more convenient day and time, transformed the overall cost and dining structure, and almost immediately started attracting new candidates.
Next we come to the renewal, and this is Tom Milner, M-E-Z. This was a dying unit. They were only getting a new member every few years and met at 11 a.m. on a Thursday as they wanted to keep evenings free, in the slightly naive belief that this would attract actors and musicians who would be otherwise engaged later in the day. It was all very inconvenient for the young professionals and recent graduates who were the chapter's target market. Paul became Scribe E and started to bring in younger people by moving meetings to a work-friendly time on Friday evening and finding a venue that made it cheaper to dine in London. The volume of new members has accelerated, so we have now added a new meeting every year and have a long waiting list. We have a ritual that is unique to the chapter. It had been rediscovered in the chapter archive in the mid-2000s and had seemingly been approved for use many decades previously, but had never been brought into use. We read it, and the consensus was we should move towards it. It doesn't change anything about the underlying Royal Arch story or the message it imparts. And so, after updating it to make sure it incorporated the recent changes required by Supreme Grand Chapter, we confirmed with the Committee of General Purposes that it was still okay to use. It tells the story in a more logical, clearer way, but without dumbing down. This allows you to appreciate the candidate's involvement and his reaction because the story is so much easier to follow. It's a shorter, more efficient and more engaging experience, and we're sure it's part of what has kept people coming back.
This is from Oliver Lynch, Chairman, Savage Club Chapter of Instruction. The Ritual. We'd been thinking of changing our ritual for a few years, and then in the archive we stumbled across the Savage Club chapter Royal Arch Ritual that Reverend Stanley Conway Lee and other members had produced in the 1970s. The most significant difference is that in other rituals, the narrative and the performance aspect are split, which means the story essentially gets run twice, whereas this version has simultaneous acting and narration. This means there is less coming and going, and it creates more roles for other participants. It's shorter and more fun to participate in, but without losing any of the gravitas of the ceremony and its underlying story, and we like to think it irons out some of the creases. We hope this keeps the character of the story, and that it is still clearly recognisable to anyone in the Royal Arch, but is a little more engaging. The new ritual has played a role in the chapter's growth, and people are intrigued by it, and we'd certainly like other people to use it. We have a chapter of instruction, and in future it would be lovely to think there are people up and down the country, and even around the world, using Savage Ritual.
Next we come to the Principal. That's Principal P-A-L, not Principal P-L-E. And this is Stephen Henderson, Haggai. Everything that takes place in Savage Ritual is the same as in the more mainstream rituals, but we like to think of it in a more logical order. It's about a significant discovery in a vault, and this is enacted in a dramatic form rather than just spoken about figuratively. When I came into the Royal Arch in the late 1980s, I thoroughly enjoyed the ceremony, but it was very serious and involved a rather daunting amount of ritual for relatively few participants to learn. With Savage Ritual, this has been slightly slimmed down and the events have been moved around. It's much better at telling an interesting story and captures the imagination more forcefully. We're very conscious that the ceremony contains a serious message and there are more people involved in the storytelling, which can make it even more meaningful. There's also a piece of ritual at the end in the form of an exhortation that sums up what the chapter is about and what we hope to achieve by being members. It's a lovely way to end the meeting because it sort of says, this is what the Royal Arch, and indeed Freemasonry as a whole, is all about. Let's now go out into the world and do all the good things it tells us to do. It's a nice message to end the meeting on and very valuable, finishing things with a warm glow.
This is from Theo M., Assistant Sojourner. The Exaltee. One of the great things as an exaltee is that you are immersed in the story the ritual is telling. You are the subject of that story, and it's more than lines of ritual going back and forth. It's almost a micro-theatre production. The story is told, and you act out parts with the members taking you through. It allows you to identify with the story and the ritual. There's a lot of rhetoric and not much action in some rituals, so afterwards you have to try and work out what actually happened. We try to recreate our ritual in a simple and memorable way. Relative to other Masonic rituals, it's by far one of my favorites because you are so immersed in it. As an officer in the chapter, every time you take part, you experience it in a slightly different role. You can relive the experience, giving you an opportunity to reflect on the story and the messages.
And we come to the Fossil. This is James Long, ADC MEZ, 1988. The Savage Club chapter was enormous fun to belong to when I was exalted in 1980. It reminded me of the quote, "You don't have to be mad to work here, but it helps," as it had a number of members who were really quite barking. Dining around a single oval table at St. Stephen's Club in Westminster seemed to me then to be the pinnacle of rather eccentric urbane companionship. As befitted a chapter with several members from the musical and acting world, the fun was boundless offstage, but once the curtain went up, the entire focus was on delivering a beautiful, thoughtful and uplifting ceremony for candidates. The chapter had several excellent ritualists who were passionate about the Royal Arch, and hence discussions about the new ritual, as it was being developed, were intense. It makes an old member proud to see that our new and young generation of companions have so naturally and perfectly captured the unique spirit of the chapter in its heyday. They've devoted so much time and energy to perfecting our rediscovered Savage Ritual and to performing it seemingly without effort. The chapter is again restored to its place as a showcase both for the Royal Arch in all its richness and for the sheer joy of companionship at its quintessential Savage best.
This is from Russell Race, Second Grand Principal. The Supreme Grand Chapter. The Savage Club chapter has a distinguished and long history. I have been fortunate enough to visit on several occasions and enjoyed it immensely. I have always come away deeply impressed by the youthful enthusiasm and companionship of its members, as well as the dramatic presentation of their unique ritual.
The second article in the Royal Arch section is entitled Eureka Moments. Looking back on his Freemasonry journey, Chris Clark reflects on the enjoyment he gets from improving the understanding of the Royal Arch and how his best ideas come to him in the bath. As Archimedes demonstrated, a bath can be the perfect place to find inspiration. And this is precisely where Chris Clark, a Freemason for more than 50 years, has come up with many of the concepts that he has used to advance the cause of the Royal Arch in his role as Deputy Metropolitan Grand Superintendent in the Royal Arch and Assistant Metropolitan Grand Master in the craft. It's a period of reflection, he says, of his inspirational bathing. Luxuriating in a warm bath is a good place to think about things. It was the same in my professional career in the city. I was writing investment analysis reports, summarising complex information in a way that was interesting and readable. Born in 1942, Clark retired from professional life when he was 70 and has since used Freemasonry as an outlet for his skills, self-expression and enthusiasm. Over the past 20 years, he's helped create materials aimed at improving the understanding and appreciation of Royal Arch Masonry in London, much of which has been adopted by the provinces and districts. I want to increase understanding and enjoyment for all companions, he says. If they enjoy it, they'll keep coming back and invite their friends. This is partly motivated by Clark's own experiences in Freemasonry. He joined the craft in 1969 and then Royal Arch 2 years later, having been, as he describes it, bundled in with no real explanation of what I was committing to. Clark doesn't want new exaltees to have that sort of confusing introduction to Royal Arch. He's aware of how difficult it can be for younger Freemasons to make the commitment required due to pressures of work and family, something he went through himself, missing meetings for about 10 years when he was helping raise 4 children while progressing his career. To aid new recruits, he has set about creating a range of products that condense and explain the complexity of Royal Arch to both exaltees and potential companions. It started with a 48-page guide given to all exaltees, explaining the history, the ritual and significance of Royal Arch. Then he created a trifold leaflet that is distributed to lodges for those interested in joining. He got insights about what to include from talking to new exaltees and inspiration for the cover while in the bath. Clark's next endeavour was to stage dramatic versions of this material in the form of 2 35-minute three-man playlets. The first, Talking Heads, is performed at lodges to show the potential appeal of the Royal Arch, while In Camera is held at Royal Arch meetings to further explore and explain the order. After a demonstration performance, provinces are given the script so they can perform it themselves. Other projects include lapel badges that can be worn to make it easier to identify Royal Arch representatives in lodges, and a banner to be hung at metropolitan offices featuring the 3 craft aprons ascending with the Royal Arch apron at the top. Another of those design concepts that come to him in the bath, incidentally. Finally, he commissioned and designed a biography of Lawrence Dermot, Grand Secretary of the Ancients, and an essential figure in early Masonry. After the book was written, Clark spent 9 months researching pictures to make it as attractive and interesting as possible. With his productive period as Deputy Metropolitan Grand Superintendent now at an end, Clark is confident his work will be carried on by others in the team. He outlines his long-term hopes for Royal Arch Masonry. I'd like to see 2 things happen in the next 10 years, he says. First, I'd like to see the average age of Royal Arch companions come down to around 40. Second, I'd like to see an increase in the percentage of craft Freemasons coming into Royal Arch from 40% to nearer 50%. I think those two things will help each other. As more young people join to bring down the age, it will encourage yet more to join the order. Now we begin the culture section, which is four book reviews. And the books are What Next by Ron Selby, The Enigma of the Royal Arch by David West. Third, we'll have Companions of Christian Rosenkreutz by various authors, and Mastering Masonic Ritual by John Burnap. So we start off with What Next by Ron Selby.
The review is written by Richard Watkins. A real joy of a book, well illustrated and highly informative. This book serves as a brief overview of the many additional degrees in Freemasonry. It is both fascinating and informative. In Selby's introduction, he asks the questions, why now and why me? There are other books covering this subject, and as the author happily confesses, his knowledge on the subject was minimal. The idea was to produce a 21st century perspective with lots of big pictures, and Selby uses his initially minimal knowledge to produce an investigative book that is entertaining, insightful, and extremely enlightening. The book covers 27 additional degrees, ranging from the commonly known Holy Royal Arch and Mark to the more esoteric, such as the Royal Order of Eri, and those that seem just plain fun. Who would not want to join Ye Ancient Order of Noble Corks, particularly when its mission is to raise funds for children's charities? Each degree includes an overview, official title, the admission requirements, history, regalia, rituals and offices, miscellanea, and contact details. It also includes a view on the likely costs involved in joining the degree, all with pictures of the accompanying ceremonial dress and jewels and an outline of the ritual. As a reference guide, it is unlikely that this title will be read cover to cover, which is a shame as each degree is covered with a love, interest and humility that allows it to uncover its gems. However, for someone considering joining a degree or looking for more information on the order that they have joined, the book certainly serves its purpose. Light and easy to read, yet comprehensive and authoritative, What Next is a real joy. I'm off to inquire about enlisting in Ye Ancient Order of Noble Corks. Anyone want to join me?
And the book is published by Lewis Masonic. It's 90 pages and it costs £12.99. The next book, The Enigma of the Royal Arch by David West. Just what is it? Interesting light shed on a very popular order. The review is by Sestrian. Arguably, no other Masonic order has caused such trouble and Masonic debate over the years as the Royal Arch. Is Chapter a fourth degree or the completion of the third? Is it really part of pure Masonry? Why is it considered necessary? And why is it loved by many but baffling to others? Come to that, what's it really all about? In this collection of 9 essays, West seeks to tease out critically the many issues arising from the Royal Arch's nature and its relationship with the craft. He has done a good deal of research, and there are maps, charts, graphs, a full bibliography and footnotes in abundance. There are also some good photos, especially of Irish chapter meeting rooms and interesting comparisons between the attitudes to the Royal Arch in Scotland, Ireland, the USA and in UGLE. Chapter's relationship to the craft emerged from the desire for unity between the self-styled ancients, who viewed the Royal Arch as an integral step, and the original Grand Lodge, which was ill-disposed to it, especially in the person of the Grand Master, the eccentric Duke of Sussex. The compromise necessary for reconciliation of the two codes and unification as the United Grand Lodge was what all compromises are. A fudge. The infamous Sussex fudge. West identifies this as the principal problem besetting the Royal Arch and its relationship with the craft. West is an experienced Masonic author, and he's not short of a viewpoint, bordering sometimes on being rather opinionated. Some of his criticisms veer towards pedantry. Nonetheless, this is a concise but well-researched and interesting tour around chapter, warts and all. It should appeal and might just answer some of the many questions raised by the enigmatic Royal Arch. And it's published by Hamilton House, 72 pages, and it costs £9.99.
The next review is for Companions of Christian Rosenkreutz by various authors, and the review is by Julian Perry. A fine collection, wide-ranging and thought-provoking papers. Rosicrucianism, as I sketched out in a book review in the autumn 2019 issue of FMT, is a complicated phenomenon. To most Freemasons, the most familiar manifestation of it is probably the popular ancient and accepted rite, with its impressive array of 33 degrees. There are also a good few other manifestations, not all of which come under the umbrella of Freemasonry. The Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia most definitely does, however, and describes itself as the oldest independent society of Rosicrucian Freemasons in the world, having existed since 1867. Members have to be Master Masons, and the emphasis of the organisation is on study and research. Every year since 2008, three members are made Companions of Christian Rosenkreutz in order to recognise their exceptional research. This most interesting book is a collection of 24 of their research papers from 2008 to 2016. The various papers are distinctly wide-ranging. A few titles will give readers a flavour. These include A Look Behind the True Meaning of Initiation, Thoughts on Wagner's Parsifal, Science or Metaphysics, and Wittgenstein in Newcastle. The papers themselves shed fascinating light on all manner of things, such as, to list just a handful, tarot mysteries, Zoroastrianism, the Invisible College, sacred geometry, the Kabbalah, Afghani Hebrews, the Korean flag, and that most extraordinary 17th century story, The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz. While this book probably won't appeal to most Freemasons, it almost certainly will to those who have any interest, other than purely superficial, in Rosicrucianism. Although decidedly arcane, the book is categorically not in any way dull. I'm no scholar, nor particularly enthralled by Rosicrucianism, but I found it pretty hard to put down.
And that book is published by Lewis Masonic, 322 pages, it costs £14.99. The final book in this section is Mastering Masonic Ritual by John Burnap, review by Reginald Church. The Right Perspective, Delivering Ritual with Meaning. Most of us these days would agree there's a lot more to great ritual than just knowing the words. Yet not all that long ago, it was common to hear half the people in a lodge room muttering away under their breath as you tried your very best to deliver your part of a ceremony. Worse still were the seasoned old-timers who, like cats lying in wait, pounced instantly on any slip-up at all so that you felt ashamed and embarrassed if you weren't word-perfect. Delivery and feeling sometimes counted for nothing, often leaving a candidate baffled as some perfectionist monotonously droned his way through page after page of ritual. John Burnap's book aims to get the delivery of our ceremonies back on track. As he puts it, many Masons dutifully learn the ritual without a thought for what the ritual is all about or why we do it. He argues that learning it by rote with no regard for its deeper meaning means not only missing out on so much, but also means learning it so much harder. He stresses that the main purpose of the ritual is to educate and inspire candidates, and that personal benefits, such as increasing one's confidence and gaining a sense of accomplishment, are absolutely secondary. A very good point he makes is that even if you're nervous about delivering a part of a ceremony, always remember there is one person who is more nervous than you, the candidate. Learning ritual is surely not about pleasing rote-learning old-timers so that one can get to the chair more quickly. Once you realise what we do is all for a candidate's benefit, the rest starts to slot into place. John Burnap's book hits the bullseye on this. And the book is available from Lewis Masonic. It's 107 pages and it's priced £15.
£15.
in the charity section this time with four short articles. Firstly, Every Little Helps. Secondly, A Legacy Milestone. Thirdly, Ecotherapy. And finally, Supporting Children's Mental Health.
On page 65, Every Little Helps. Simple chores like unpacking the groceries can be incredibly challenging for people with complex disabilities. Canine partners can prove a lifeline. We all know the routine. Number 1. Write out a shopping list for your weekly trip to the supermarket. Number 2. Peruse the aisles looking for that particular condiment, specific brand of coffee, or the discounted bargain corner that you can never seem to find. Number 3. Come home having bought half the shop and begin a game of Tetris, trying to fit everything into the cupboards. Number 4. Relax with a new packet of biscuits and your favourite hot drink, feeling productive but a little tired. For many people, this weekly activity is the same and one that, pre-pandemic, we took for granted. Post-lockdown, it seems many of us now look forward to these trips, an appreciation developed from a taste of normality and the chance to stretch our legs beyond the walls of our homes. However, this normal part of life is one only experienced by those physically able. People with independence-limiting disabilities don't always have the luxury of browsing the shelves or popping to the shops. In fact, many are reliant on additional support to help them navigate through these everyday parts of life. This can come in many different forms, young or old, big or small, human or furry. Canine Partners is a national charity that provides assistance dogs to meet the needs of people living with complex disabilities. These specially trained pups are carefully matched to an individual's lifestyle, no matter how challenging, and can help carry out a variety of tasks, from opening and closing doors, unloading the washing machine, stripping the bed, to, you guessed it, helping with the shopping. One service user's limited mobility has meant she's always relied on the Tesco delivery driver to carry her shopping into the kitchen. However, when the pandemic hit and social distancing measures came into force, the driver was no longer able to provide this extra step of support. In response, her assistance dog learned to get a washing basket, place the shopping items in, and drag it into the kitchen, where its owner could then unpack. A simple task made complex through disability, creatively solved by a four-legged friend. The Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, has announced £30,000 in funding for Canine Partners to support the charity in providing assessments, training and aftercare for all its beneficiaries. This grant will ensure that the daily needs of service users are met, from unloading the dishwasher to carrying in a Tesco delivery, because every little helps. Can the MCF help you? If you are unable to work, facing redundancy or struggling with additional household costs, the MCF may be able to help. Contact the inquiries team today at help@mcf.org.uk or call 0800 035 6090.
A legacy milestone. Since the launch of the Masonic Charitable Foundation's, that's MCF, the Freemasons charity, free will writing service with the Goodwill Partnership, more than 500 people have used it to write their will and provide for loved ones. 89% of those who have used the service have a connection to Freemasonry, whether they're a Freemason themselves or a Freemason's partner, child or grandchild. London is the largest geographical area of these will makers, followed by second West Lancashire and third Northamptonshire and Huntingdonshire. 11% of those who've used the MCF's will writing service have no connection to Freemasonry. The service is open to anyone and everyone. The youngest will maker is 25 years old. The oldest is 90. Whatever your age or your circumstances, it's important to make a will to ensure your wishes are carried out after you die and your loved ones are provided for. 1/3 of UK adults die without having written a will, also known as dying intestate. And this can cause huge emotional, practical and financial consequences at an already difficult time. If you have yet to make a will and would like guidance on the process, visit www.mcf.org.uk /FMTSummer2021/legacy, where you can download or order the MCF's Making a Will Guide and find out more about the MCF's free will writing.
Ecotherapy. Kent Wildlife Trust, a conservation charity that focuses on bringing people closer to nature, has teamed up with the NHS to deliver eco-based therapies to people living with dementia. The project will work closely with the Harmonia Village in Dover, which is the first of its kind, an NHS residential village that uses a person-centred approach to dementia care. The Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, is funding a nature and well-being officer who will deliver a programme of activities to village residents. These will include simple wildlife gardening, such as sowing seeds, pruning and planting, wildlife watching and identification, landscape painting and photography. This scheme will help combat the loneliness and isolation that is associated with dementia and aims to improve the well-being of each individual.
And finally in this section, an article entitled Supporting Children's Mental Health. Last year, Freemasons across England and Wales rose to the challenge of raising £1 million for the Freemasons COVID-19 Community Fund as a response to the unfolding pandemic.
After just 16 weeks, the target had not only been met but exceeded, and the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, delivered on its promise of matching every pound, taking the fund to more than £2 million. Since then, the MCF has been working in partnership with UGLE and provinces to identify vulnerable communities that have been worst hit by the crisis. As a result, the Freemasons COVID-19 Community Fund has focused on supporting three core areas of society: the homeless and vulnerably housed community, unpaid carers, and, most recently announced, children and young people struggling with their mental health. What is mental health? Well, good mental health is a person's ability to think, feel, and react in ways that are needed to live a stable and balanced lifestyle. Poor mental health sees an individual experience difficult thoughts, feelings, and reactions that may leave them unable to cope. These can be just as hard to manage as physical illnesses. Impact of COVID-19 on young people's mental health. A December 2020 report by Public Health England showed that there had been significant changes in mental health and well-being, with stress, depression and anxiety peaking for adults in April 2020. For some children and young people, social distancing and the stay-at-home instruction appears to have increased emotional, behavioural and restlessness or attention difficulties, as well as anxiety and depression. In April 2020, almost half of 16 to 24-year-olds surveyed showed new symptoms of psychological distress and reported an increase in anxiety over the summer months, when this emotion in surveyed adults appeared to reduce. Only 27% of children and young people had had a one-to-one session with a teacher in which they were asked about their well-being, while almost a quarter of respondents, 23%, said there was less mental health support from their school in comparison to before the pandemic. Freemasonry's response is that the third round of funding from the Freemasons COVID-19 Community Fund will support charities tackling poor mental health in young people, with the aim of helping them recover from a difficult year. Applications have now closed and the MCF is reviewing every application.
Now we come to the letters to the editor. The opinions expressed here are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the views of the United Grand Lodge of England. All UGLE members' letters printed are appended with the contributor's name, his mother lodge and number, the town where the lodge meets and the province. So please include these details at the foot of your letter and include an SAE for any item sent by mail that you wish to have returned. The first letter is a eulogy for Brother Edukimi. It's from Anthony E.J., Enugu Lodge, number 5440, EC, Nigeria. He writes, "Sir, I am fortunate to have known Brother Ejikimi for the last 14 months. We met for the first time at the installation meeting of Enugu Lodge No. 5440 in October 2019. Brother Ejikimi was incumbent secretary of Enugu Lodge No. 5440 EC. Before the installation, I had sent an email to Brother Ejikimi asking him to add my name to brethren attending the festive board. He refused to do so, citing the deadline for doing so as having passed. Brother Ejikimi was a time-conscious Freemason. On the day of the installation, I arrived early to socialise with brethren before business. I sighted Brother Ejikimi dressed up in his officer's regalia and waiting in the lodge, which was adjacent to the cloakroom where I was. He looked relaxed and was waiting for brethren to take their seats. I approached him to introduce myself, and on sighting me he smiled as if he'd seen an old friend. We exchanged pleasantries and spoke of how we both knew the Master-elect and the history of Enugu Lodge No. 5440 EC, which is legendary. Brother Ejikimi was a devoted Freemason. After the installation, we continued to discuss Freemasonry and the formation of Nigeria Heritage Lodge, proposed to be consecrated under the Provincial Grand Lodge of Surrey. Brother Ejikimi was full of optimism about the potential the lodge had as a tool for doing good in the wider society. Brother Ejikimi was a night owl and would call me after midnight to exchange ideas and discuss matters affecting formation of Nigeria Heritage Lodge. Brother Ejikimi was a proactive Freemason. My last conversation with Brother Ejikimi reassures me that he is in a good place. His sincerity is why I will miss him the most. It was a privilege to have known him, and it was a sincere honour to call him my friend and brother.
Sir, in the spring edition of FMT, companion Nigel Blore suggested that there remain two distinct views on Royal Arch, and referred to Jim Daniels' article that the 1813 settlement was indeed a fudge. As in most things, everyone is entitled to their opinion, but I cannot let these comments pass without a response. I believe that the Royal Arch has very broad shoulders and any constructive criticism or commentary should be welcomed and considered, but I would challenge the contention that there are two distinct views on Royal Arch. Whereas I do not disagree with Nigel Blore, I would suggest that there are many other points of view ranging from the academic and historical perspective to those who just enjoy the ceremonies. The 2004 revisions were entirely appropriate as they addressed certain ritualistic elements that required adjustment and tried to make the language more comprehensible by removing arcane and unnecessarily complex symbolic imagery. It is my understanding that individual companions are encouraged to form their own opinion of the Royal Arch and its relevance to their lives, as opposed to the more prescriptive approach to the craft where a great deal of information is available. The Royal Arch may be considered the thinking man's order, as it initially presents itself in a very colourful and solemn ceremony, with beautiful ritual and prayers, but on further examination there are many fascinating symbolic concepts hidden beneath. The problem with this discovery is that it must rightly be driven by the individual's curiosity to seek out the covert or hidden meanings that he finds relevant to himself. This, of course, requires some effort, but once that journey has begun, each discovery leads to another, and what at first appears to be just spoken ritual leads to a far deeper understanding of not only the Royal Arch, but the craft as well. This is alluded to in the phrase, the connection of the whole system and relative dependence of its several parts. I believe that rather than be diverted by a factual examination of the structure of the Royal Arch, though it is useful to have an understanding of the historical framework, our focus should be on what the ritual and the ceremonies are trying to tell us, and in so doing, yield a greater satisfaction from our eventual attendance. Geoffrey Manikandam, Friars Hiram Chapter, Number 1349.
And if you want to write a letter to the editor, you write to the editor, FMT, Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street, London, WC2B 5AZ, or email editor@freemasonrytoday.com. And just before we finish, we have a clarification. In the spring edition of FMT, we printed a letter from Worshipful Brother Wilmoth, which said that Brother Johnston, whose letter was published in the winter edition, wanted to remove or water down the ritual. Brother Johnstone has asked us to clarify that he did not say that he wished to remove or water down the ritual, but rather use modern technology to assist participants during the ritual. He has also asked us to reiterate that his views are personal and not those of his lodges. We apologise to Brother Johnston for any upset caused. Well, that completes the reading of this edition of FMT Today, issue number 54 for summer 2021. Thank you for listening.